Education and Innovation Policy will come to order. It is Thursday, March 8th. Are the microphones? Yes, the microphones are on. Thank you. I just couldn't tell. So I've called the meeting officially to order. Members, this meeting could very possibly reconvene, be recessed and reconvene at about 4:30 or so. That is because the policy bill from the governor has gotten a little bit larger, so we're going to need to spend more time on it. So that will be the last bill on the agenda today, and then probably continue when we reconvene. So just wanted you to know that, and also to know that next week is our last week to hear bills, and Ms. Peterson is busy posting the agendas, so you will know whether you're up Tuesday already, and you will know shortly whether you're up Thursday. And then that week after is our omnibus bill, because we have a 22nd of March deadline to have our omnibus bill out. So just be aware of that, please, and I appreciate your being here on time so we can get our business completed in a timely and professional fashion. With that, we're going to move to the minutes. Representative Pryor, would you be so kind as to review the minutes and move approval? Representative Pryor moves approval of the March 6, 2018 minutes. Is there any discussion or corrections or additions? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye. 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 Those opposed, nay. The motion prevails and the minutes are approved. First on our agenda today are a couple of bills that deal with preferences for charter schools, and Representative Daniels is going to present both his and Representative Garofalo's. So, Representative Daniels, if you don't mind going to the testifying table. Members, this is House File 2843, first, and 2752, second. And we'll be laying over, or I will be laying over both proposals for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. Representative Daniels, welcome to the testifying table. Please say your name for the record and move your House file.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Committee, for taking time to hear two bills today. I'll be presenting House File 2843 and House File 2752. They are very similar bills. I do have some testifiers with me. Is it okay to bring up at this time?
Of course. So Representative Daniels moves House File 2843, and it will be laid over for possible inclusion. So Representative Daniels, will you say a little bit more about what 2843 does, please?
Yes, Madam Chair. Thank you. What we're looking for is in my district, Near Strand Charter School has been there for a number of years. I've visited it probably four or five times. I know a lot of the parents and children who go to that school and have gone to that school, and very, very, very good school. We've been involved in some of the fundraisers over the years. I think the first time that one of my coworkers, Tim Hegseth, and his wife Jenny started a fundraiser. It was an auction, and I think the first year they raised over $20,000. And this is a town of under 300. I think by the third or fourth year they were at, I'm guessing around 40, maybe over 40,000 for this one night auction. So the community is really involved. So what we're looking for is having a little bit more protections for those people that are involved in the community that actually support it financially and they volunteer. So we're looking at a five-mile radius to fill the school lottery system before If there's any open seats after 5 miles, then the lottery would extend past the 5 mile radius. And that's kind of what it is. I brought my administrator of the school, Maggie Kiley, and I got one of the parents here of two children that are here today, Lisa, and so I thought I'd turn it over to Maggie next and let her kind of tell a little more history on the school.
Before you do that, Representative Daniels, members, a few years ago, Representative Mary Murphy had kind of started this path with getting preference for a charter school into Duluth Township in St. Louis County that would have a preferred enrollment as well. So precedent has been set. However, please feel free to ask questions of the testifiers or of those who will have concerns. Welcome to our committee. Please say your name for the record and begin.
Margaret Kiley. I'm the director of Near Strand School.
Well, welcome. We're glad to have you.
Thank you. Well, first of all, I'm very grateful to Representative Daniels. He responded very quickly to my initial request and has been very enthusiastic about helping us, and we are so appreciative of it. I have been a part of Near Strand School since 1995, first as a classroom teacher and now as director in my third year. The town of Near Strand is about 15 miles east of Faribault. It's a community of a little over 200 people. The town is surrounded by fields on all sides. And this little town has had its own school since 1887. It was the original founders that began this school. It is a source of great pride within the community. That although other rural communities around us saw their schools become closed, especially in the 1970s when rural schools were being incorporated into larger districts, the Near Strand managed to keep its little school open. Our school is small. It's a K-5 building. We have about 150 students. And we became a charter school in 1999, and I was part of that initial conversion. I'm seeking an exception to the law because our school is so closely linked to the small community that we reside in. One of the missions of our school has been to do outreach into the town of Near Strand. We hold regular community coffees where we invite all of the Near Strand residents, whether they are grandparents or parents of children at the school, to come in monthly and meet our students and find out about different events in the school. We also have every May Day, every child in our building goes out and delivers May baskets to every resident in the town.
Wow.
We also, every year, our fourth and fifth graders interview a community elder from Near Strand, and with the help of their music teacher, they compose a song based on that community elder, and then we perform that concert every spring. We've been doing that for about 20 years. We have now honored over 40 elders, including former Governor Al Quie. We had him a couple of years ago. So the school and the town are very closely connected. And because of this connection, we want to make sure that families that reside within a five-mile radius have the opportunity and feel confident that their children will be able to attend their neighborhood school. It would be a benefit to our small town to give families a preferred status in admissions. Sadly, in the last year, in the town of Near Strand, two important businesses have closed, the one gas station convenience store and the local implement dealer. Having this exception, I believe, would not only strengthen the sense of community in our own school, but it would also be a great benefit to our small rural town. So thank you for considering our proposal.
Thank you, Ms. Kiley, and thank you for your leadership in your school. That's so important. Welcome, Ms. Flieger. Please say your name for the record and begin. And this is a parent who I believe has children with her. So, children, will you stand up and just wave at us? Because you're most important in this committee. Our children, absolutely. That's why we exist, to set education policy for our children. Welcome. Please say your name.
So my name is Lisa Flieger. I'm a parent of two kids currently going to Near Strand School. When Meg asked if I would come, I thought, you know, what a great opportunity. I personally dealt with this. When the kids were young, we would all sit around the playground and talk about whether we were going to get our kids in or if we, you know, what we were going to do if they didn't get in. I had actually signed my kids up for another school, not knowing if we were going to be accepted. And I got that acceptance letter before I got the one from Nearstrand. So it's, you know, not the most efficient use of the system when I had to call them after I got my acceptance into Nearstrand and say, okay, I don't need that. I also have a cousin that moved to town with the hope of getting her kids in there. And I know if she doesn't get them in, then she's considering moving out of town. You know, and it's a great community. The parents all look out for each other's kids. You know, I mean, these kids come over after school, you know, and everybody kind of helps out. If something happens, people go talk to other people's parents. And I just think it's so important for our little community to keep our kids there.
Thank you, Ms. Fleeker. Are there questions for the testifiers? Representative Rarick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The main question I would have, if your children didn't get into Nearstrand, how far would you have to go to get to another school?
Ms. Fleeker.
About 20 miles.
Representative Kunish-Bedin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for testifying. Your description of your little school sounds very much like the little school that I went to. We were just a first through eighth grade of every grade level and all the way down to those May baskets. So that was a nice memory. My first question is, why is this a charter school rather than a public school?
Ms. Kiley.
So when I initially started teaching at Nearstrand, we were actually part of the Faribault School District. Mm-hmm. So in the 70s, I believe that when so many rural schools closed, Faribault incorporated Nearstrand School into their district. The group of us that were teaching at the school at that time had never considered converting to a charter, and that was at the very early stages of charter, because we're coming up on almost 20 years of being a charter school. But there were some, we knew that there were some budget things coming up in Faribault, and there had always been this worry that if they were going to close the school, the one that's 15 miles out of town would make the most sense because they were busing kids out. And so at the time, the law was you couldn't close and then just reopen as a charter. Mm-hmm. And so we decided, and with a great deal of support from Faribault, they have been fantastic to us because they own the building. But with their blessing, we converted. So we were initially a traditional public school.
Great, thank you. And then one other question. So do you have a lot of open enrollment? I know it sounds to me like you're trying to, you know, keep it local, but do you is it such a great school that other families from a long distance are willing to have their kids come in themselves?
We do have the majority of people that come to our school actually reside in Faribault. The reason that I'm moving towards this is that we have seen, we right now within the community of Nearstrand, I think we have close to 30 children under the age of 5. And again, because of, I would never want to exclude anyone, but because we have this strong connection to this community and there's this really deep history, and also because I would like to see, we're rural, and the town is struggling, and so I'd like to be able to sort of have this for the town, that they can embrace the school fully, and that this would be a benefit to people moving to the community.
Sure. Do you have a large open enrollment population?
You know, our school is so small, so this year it's mainly the kindergarten section that everyone is interested in. So we always fill with siblings of current children first. And so right now we probably have, for next year, I think we have 12 openings after siblings come in.
Wow.
So.
Wonderful. All right. Thank you very much.
Representative Ward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I appreciate all of the questions because some of my questions have been answered then already. Who is the authorizer for this school?
Ms. Riley.
Our authorizer is NEO Novations Education Opportunities. Wendy Swanson Choi is the director or the chair of that of, our authorizer.
Representative Pryor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is a question I have for the author. So we have two bills that look pretty similar, and in statute we read there's another case similar to this. Had you considered putting in language that generalized this situation, possibly, to other rural schools that are charter schools and are there for the community, and that which I understand the thinking behind it, which seems a very powerful and very positive idea. So is that something that you and perhaps Representative Garofalo are looking into?
Representative Daniels.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Pryor, I just found out about Representative Garofalo's bill yesterday. We have not talked about his bill yet, but it kind of makes sense to me that this might be the start of something so our charter schools can, just like we do in the Nearstrand, you're trying to protect our own assets in the smaller communities. There's just so much community put into it, volunteering and fundraising, and I think this might be a start of something that's going to be continuing, and I'm sure we'll have some other opinions later on in our presentation here. Thank you.
Thank you, testifiers. And we're going to hear now from some who have concerns. So if you would vacate your seats so they could come forward. Eugene Piccolo and the Department of Education would like to express some concern about this kind of proposal. Representative Daniels, you could stay there. Remember, you're going to do the next bill, too.
Okay. Yep.
Welcome, Mr. Piccolo. Please say your name for the record and begin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Eugene Piccolo, the Executive Director of the Minnesota Association of Charter Schools. While enrollment preferences have at the root a very noble goal, enrollment preferences can also have unintended consequences. And as the Chair mentioned, one of the unintended consequences of a bill that was put in 5 years ago now was that we have other bills like this to give geographical preferences. So with that in mind, the Minnesota Association of Charter Schools believes that before the legislature enacts any other enrollment preferences beyond those are currently in law, which is for siblings, automatic enrollment preference, and school boards of charter schools can grant a preference for the children of staff of charter schools by board action. Before any others are put in place, we first say that charter schools need to be more aggressive in their outreach and recruitment initiatives in the areas they see they want to seek students, that their charter school contracts need to include measurable and demonstrable goals in terms of their outreach and recruitment so that authorizers can hold them accountable for that. And second, there needs to be an analysis of enrollment preferences that needs to be undertaken so that we do not create other unintended consequences beyond those that already have been done, and which undermine parental and student choice and result in quasi-private academies. Charter schools are public schools. They are not private academies. The bottom line questions in examining enrollment preferences are, how does an enrollment preference respect and encourage parental and student choice, inclusion, and diversity in student enrollments, and how does it or does not maintain the public character of chartered public schools? So while we understand and are very sympathetic to the intent of legislation, we urge extreme caution and ask you to examine enrollment preferences with those questions in mind as there are broader issues involved, and consider the collective impact of enrollment preferences on the overall character of chartered public schools.
Thank you, Mr. Piccolo. Mr. Uni, please say your name for the record and begin.
Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Dosh Uni, Director of Government Relations. appreciate the opportunity to make some comments on this bill. I had the short opportunity to connect with Representative Daniels yesterday regarding some of our concerns, and would largely echo Mr. Piccolo's concerns. And you know, the department recognizes the precedent set in 2014. This is something I believe the department expressed concerns about at that point. And again, echoing Mr. Piccolo's concerns, you know, each time there is a new preference proposed, we do need to be very cautious about understanding the impacts that it has. Again, as was said, charters are meant to serve all students and create choice. And this creates creates a quasi-border for the school, and that's something that charters specifically don't have. They don't have boundaries like traditional district schools. And being able to pick and choose based on a characteristic is dangerous in a model that is meant to try to serve all students and create choice for parents and students. So we would just urge caution in creating new preferences under the charter school model. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Uni and Mr. Piccolo. But the preference did occur in 2014, and so the groundwork was laid. And, you know, it's a little hard to deny these folks when that's already occurred. Mr. Piccolo.
Madam Chair, and I just want to say we opposed it at that time.
I know you did.
And
I did too.
We continue to oppose geographical preferences. Thank you.
Yes, we honor the law, though. When it becomes the law, we honor it. Are there any questions for these testifiers? Representative Rarick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Not so much a question, just as we speak to unintended consequences in regards to the question I had, how far they would have to go. I think when you have an open enrollment in a rural area like this, an unintended consequence of having this lottery system is sending kids much further distances to get to school. You'll have kids from this town traveling 20 miles to Faribault and kids from Faribault traveling 20 miles to this school. I don't think that's right either. I mean, I realize 20 miles isn't far, but it can, like we talked about yesterday, in property taxes and other ones. Mm-hmm. In these rural areas, in bad weather, that 20 miles can be a long way. And the other thing, in a small town like this, you have two kids who might be next-door neighbors, have been friends since they've been 1 year old, or since they've been old enough to know each other, and now one's going to have to go to a different school because they couldn't get in because of the lottery system. So I think, realistically, for a small rural town, it makes sense to give this exemption.
Are there other questions for the testifiers? Thank you very much, both of you. Representative Daniels, closing comments on House File 2843.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, committee. Thank you for the comments. This is kind of a unique situation. We have a town of under 300 people. There's 140 some student openings are available in the school itself. So beyond the 5 mile radius, there are still going to be seats to fill. So there are going to be children that want to go to that school. And I know it's been talked about. They always want to get in there, and sometimes it's difficult. So I think I don't think there's any downside to doing this. And I really appreciate the time of the committee and Madam Chair, time for it to present. And I just would urge us to move this forward. And if I'm correct, Madam Chair, it's going to be laid over a possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Is that correct?
Representative Daniels, the chair renews her motion, coupled with your motion that 2843 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. Thank you. And Representative Daniels, you've been so kind as to sit in for Representative Garofalo, who could not be present this morning since it's a very similar bill. The chair will move House File 2752 for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. Representative Daniels, what would you like to say about Representative Garofalo's proposal?
Well, I know I don't have any good jokes as Representative Garofalo, but not having a chance to speak to him, I'm assuming that it's very similar circumstances, just a little different population. So his bill will have a 2 mile radius, and I'm kind of in a dangerous territory. I'm making assumptions for the same reasons that they have a very strong charter school and they'd like to keep it to the local community first and then expand out once those seats open up.
Thank you, Representative Daniels. This is a proposal that Representative Groffalo brought forward last year, and we just did not get to it. So are there any questions probably for the previous testifiers from charter schools or the department? Seeing none, the chair renews her motion that House File 2752 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. Thank you, Representative Daniels. That moves us to House File 3173, which is a proposal to, and I'll move that on behalf of Representative Loon and me. The chair moves House File 3173 to be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. Members, what 3173 does is it moves the intermediate districts from higher education into the education code. And if you have any questions, I think Ms. Parra could answer those. This is just a process that we want to use so that we are directly taking purview over intermediates because we deal with them all the time. So they should be in our education code for K-12 or E-12, if you prefer, rather than higher ed. Is there any discussion? Representative Mariano.
Madam Chair, I think this makes a lot of sense. I'm actually surprised. I just learned something. I didn't realize they were under our code. Do you know anything about the history, why that ended up, or the quirky thing that happened? Or?
I think when they were developed or created, that intermediates were more aligned with higher education. But, Ms. Parra, do you have any history? I just know there was that closer relationship. I think it was Representative Carlson, in fact, who created this. Ms. Parra.
Madam.
Yes.
Madam Chair, Representative Mariani, my understanding is that when these were first codified in the 130s chapter, it was near a, sort of a vocational education
yes.
chapter. And since that's the intermediates, you know, originally were doing more of that and have mm-hmm. kind of moved more into the special ed area. They've just stayed there, and now there's a proposal to move them into the K-12 area.
Thank you for that history question, though, Representative Mariani, and thank you for your answer, Ms. Parra. Is there any further discussion? With that, the chair renews her motion that House File 3173 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. Representative Bennett, welcome to the testifying
there,
table.
And actually, it's perfect
they're
timing.
Not here yet?
No, I actually see them. They're
just
here.
Arriving.
Perfect timing, yes. Thank you.
Well, we could do, no, we'll do your bill.
I don't know.
We'll do your bill.
Thank you.
And members, this is House File 3190, and this will be referred to the Committee on Education Finance. So all of those who are here for Representative Bennett's bill, welcome, and come forward. You may not all want to sit at the testifying table right away, but if you're close by, we can do kind of a circle of chairs. Yes. Representative Bennett, welcome to the testifying table, and would you please move 3190?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move House File 3190. For possible inclusion in the...
And members, there is an amendment. The chair will move House H3190A1 amendment. Will you explain that, please, Representative Bennett?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes. This is simply putting this law, or putting this in this area of statute to make the funding work. So it's the same goal, but just putting it in a correct area of statute.
Is there any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor of the A1 amendment, please say aye. Aye. Those opposed, nay. The motion prevails, and the bill is in the order you want it. Again, welcome, Representative Bennett, and to your testifiers. Please explain why you're adding career technical education to the extended time for pupil units.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members, for hearing this bill. And I'm going to let my testifiers actually do most of the talking. This bill provides state aid for students taking vocational classes outside the school day. Currently, if these classes are offered outside the school day, they are not funded, but if they are offered within the school day, they are funded. I had the opportunity, along with Representative Gunther, to visit the Fairmont schools last Saturday and got to see firsthand their morning welding class, which, by the way, a quarter of the students are girls, which I thought was really exciting to see girls in a welding class. But I was very, very impressed with this program. I was very impressed with the flexibility that it allows for students who, during the school day, maybe would not be able to take this class for one reason or another or similar classes. And I'm going to let our superintendent explain why. But the other thing I wanted to add was I was also impressed with the collaboration this allows with other school districts. And there was a number of Blue Earth students. Blue Earth's, what, about 20 miles east of Fairmont. Those students were able to take a welding class. Their district, I don't believe, offers that. So what a good way to share resources and collaborate among school districts. So I'm going to let my testifiers take it from here.
Welcome, Superintendent Brown.
Thank you,
and,
Madam Chair.
And please say your name for the record and begin.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Joseph E. Brown, Sr. I'm superintendent of Fairmont Area Schools. I have with me today Andy Trado, who's our vocational principal, Robert Bodine, who's our welding teacher, Adam Carstensen, a 12th grade student, and Anna Nordquist, our best welder, by the way, an 11th grade student. Minnesota needs additional skilled workers, welders, carpenters, plumbers, and electricians. We have observed that many of our students do not have time during their regularly scheduled school day to take a vocational class. So Fairmont has implemented summer welding academy classes and Saturday welding academy classes in addition to our summer agriculture classes. Currently, as Representative Bennett mentioned, we have 20 students taking a 15-week, 4-hour-a-day welding class on Saturdays from 8 o'clock in the morning until 12 noon. Mm-hmm. 11 students are from Blue Earth Area High School, 3 students from Grenada-Huntley East Chain, 2 students from Fairmont, and 4 adults, 5 women, 15 men. House File 3190, as amended, is a nonpartisan bill. It will have a positive impact on all parts of our great state of Minnesota, rural and urban. Eventually, most people will need a skilled worker to build or remodel their home, whether one resides on the Iron Range or in the metro or in rural Minnesota. Minnesota is blessed with a variety of manufacturing plants that are crying out for skilled workers, skilled welders, turret lathe operators, carpenters, plumbers, and electricians. I've attached copies of the class schedules of the two students that are with us here today to demonstrate that their class schedule is full, and the only time for them to take a vocational class is in the summer, in the evening, or on Saturdays. I do not believe that this is a very expensive bill, because very few Minnesota high schools still have comprehensive vocational programs. And very few high schools have teachers that are willing to come and teach on a Saturday or in the summer or in the evening. And very few schools have students that are willing to get up and drive 30 miles for an 8 o'clock class on a Saturday for 4 hours. This bill also will encourage school districts to recruit and retain vocational workers that may be year-round employees. It's my opinion that if we're going to continue vocational classes in the state of Minnesota, to get a vocational teacher, we're going to have to consider hiring him or her 12 months. Otherwise, they're going to go into the private sector and not be available for our students. I want to publicly thank Representative Peggy Bennett and Fairmont's State Representative Bob Gunther for personally visiting our Saturday welding class. And I'd be glad to yield to any questions after the rest of the folks testify, Madam Chairman.
Thank you, Superintendent Brown. Mr. Trailo, please say your name for the record and begin.
Yeah, my name is Andrew Trado. I am the principal for grade 7, 8 in our vocational programs at Fairmont Junior Senior High School.
Excuse me, sir, but is that a handout? That needs to go to the page. Matthias. Mr. Trado will get the page to hand that out.
Okay.
Thank you. Please proceed.
All right, thank you. Yeah, again, my name is Andrew Trado. I'm the principal for grades 7, 8 in our vocational programs at Fairmont Junior Senior High School. I've been a teacher and administrator for 15 years and have had the privilege of observing great progress in education during my tenure, and it's an honor to be here today to speak on behalf of our schools, our students, our communities, and most importantly, the future of our great state. In 2014, as you know, Minnesota enacted legislation to ensure all schools develop a focus on the future of our state's workforce. The world's best workforce legislation was enacted in part to solidify Minnesota's presence as a competitive, viable workforce market for our future generations. According to the Minnesota Department of Education, for Minnesota to be competitive, we must have students who are career and college ready, students who are poised to lead the state's workforce. While we are striving to ensure all students are ready to be contributors to society, it is no secret we are facing a shortage of skilled workers. By the year 2022, Minnesota is expected to face a shortage of over 270,000 workers. The seven-county metro area alone is predicted to see a shortfall of over 60,000 workers in the next 2 years. According to the National Career Readiness Indicator, in conjunction with our Minnesota ACT results, our students across the state are demonstrating the abilities to leave our schools ready to enter a career field. With the combination of our students demonstrating the ability to contribute and the gap in our skilled labor force, this legislation will only have a positive impact on our students and workforce. All areas of trades work are facing the challenge of recruiting skilled workers. Locally, we have collaborated with electricians, plumbers, and welders to analyze how we can serve each other to meet these demands. With the help of the newly adopted tiered licensure system and this proposal for increased funding for career and technical education, opportunities outside the regular school day, we will be able to offer enriching experiences for our learners who otherwise would be unable to access these educational opportunities. I believe each and every student possesses talents and gifts that can be exposed and developed through these courses. Our own students, whom you'll hear from today, have seen the value of experiencing learning outside their regularly scheduled classes. Each has demonstrated skills that prove they are talented in many areas of their schooling. With full schedules and course requirements, the classes offered in the summer months and on weekends have allowed for these learners to expand their skill sets beyond the traditional boundaries of the school day. Additionally, students with varying academic abilities have been able to acquire skills they otherwise would not have been able to. Personally, I have observed students at the top of their class working on projects that they are passionate about. And one of the most moving examples I can share is that of a student with special needs demonstrating proper welding techniques to a group of beginning welders in our metals shop. By offering courses beyond the school day, learners in our area of the state have garnered more voice and choice over what and when they're able to learn and develop a skill. Through your support, more and more students will have these opportunities to advance their preparation in career-related fields. With an accelerating need for skilled labor, we need to ensure students have the opportunity to accelerate the acquisition of these skills that will help them be successful in their futures. One of my favorite quotes is, "The greatest reason to grow is to have more to give to others." We hope to use this opportunity to be able to continue and grow our offerings beyond the school day so that the future of our state, which is our students, have more to give as they embark on their future endeavors. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Trado, and thank you so much for your work with our students. What you have said here is invaluable to our future. Thank you again, all of you, for coming. Mr. Bonin, yes. I think you're going to speak next. And
yes,
welcome.
Thank you.
Please say your name for the record.
So, Madam Chairwoman and members of the committee, I am Robert Bonin. I am a CTE teacher in Fairmont High School. CTE is a new term for an old phrase, vocational education. So I'm probably more aware of the huge deficit in the Minnesota skilled work force that we have throughout the state. I'm the one on the front line working with those in the community. So I'm well aware of the welders, the assemblers, the carpenters, plumbers, heating and ventilating, air conditioning technicians, mechanics, and electricians that are in shortage right now. Our local manufacturers and small business owners contact me monthly asking for more workers. Mm-hmm. And so with that search, over the 12 years that I've been at the high school, I have observed many of our own students that do not have the time to regularly attend one of my classes based on quite a few reasons. Unfortunately, some of the students that are interested in becoming a skilled workers may have to repeat some of their current core classes because they do not pass them on their first attempt. This jams them up from their daily scheduled classes and creates a need for us to offer this Saturday welding academy or a summer welding academy so that those students who do not fit into the classes into their current schedule have an opportunity to get into that class to find out if that skilled labor is for them. An additional number of our students cannot take the class during the traditional school day due to the number of things in their schedule that are required, like maths and sciences and Englishes and history classes that they need to graduate. So approximately 15% of the students that I do get in my 9th through 12th grade classes that we train in our regularly schooled programs, this would include our Saturdays school welding and our summer school welding academies, are going to enter the welding workforce after graduation and go on to attend an 18-month training program at a secondary institution for welding. The benefit of my program is funding trained, skilled workforce ready to enter in our great state of Minnesota. We currently have 16 of our students from the past 7 years in our local welding workforce in Martin County. I passed around some samples of the welds to you. Those are from my intro class. The students practice a basic weld technique. We call it a weave. When they're done with those plates, you should be able to look at them on the side, and it should look like one continuous piece of metal. The collegiate requires 3 or less defects per weld test. The smaller triangle one is Anna's weld. If you look at it closely, there are 0 defects. This comes from a highly skilled class with good fundamental techniques. This is developed through this Saturday weld school, through this welding academy. Otherwise, Anna would not have been able to take in that class. And so that's the skill that our workforce needs. I'm very passionate about what I do. I would love to see that this bill moves forward so that students like Anna and Adam can continue to have this opportunity to enter our great state's workforce. I want to publicly thank my state representative, Bob Gunther, and State Representative Peggy Bennett for personally coming down and visiting my Saturday weld class last Saturday. They had an opportunity to see kind of a conglomerate of different types there. We do have 5 women in that class, 5 females in the class out of the 20. We have a few adults. We have some high school students, and they coexist together for one common good. They're all wanting to go on to this welding trade. So I thank you. If you have any further questions, I would be available.
Thank you, Mr. Bonin. Welcome. We have 2 students with us today, and Ms. Nordquist, will you say your name for the record, and please tell us about your experience in this program.
Thank you, Madam Chairwoman. My name is Anna Nordquist, and I'm currently a junior at Fairmont High School, and I'm taking the Saturday welding course. So I always knew about the vocational courses offered at Fairmont High School, such as drafting and welding, but not until I took introduction to woodworking my freshman year, I really got interested into it. But after my freshman year, my class schedule became quite full. We have 7 classes per semester, and all of mine were filled up with already all my classes. So when I saw one day a flyer for the summer welding course, I right away went and signed up with it with Mr. Bonin. I didn't really know what to expect because I didn't really understand what welding was at the time. But through these courses, I have learned so much more than just how to weld. I've learned self-discipline and, like, just motivating yourself to be better. And I became interested in these kind of classes probably from my dad, because he took many vocational courses in high school and in college, and he didn't make his skills into a career, but he used them in everyday home repair and fix-ups and add-ons, and I just saw that as such a useful life skill to use in the future. So even if I don't go on to college into welding, or into some other vocational course, I'll be able to use this as a fallback career or a summer job or just anything. If someone needs help, if this... especially in today's world, we need more vocational jobs because even on the way up here, I just saw a sign for hiring mechanics, and we need them everywhere and so forth. So I really learned how to grow in welding, in skill, because trades are important. Because even welders and plumbers and electricians do what industrial machines can't. Industrial machines can make the product, but we need the people to put it together. Because you can't put a machine down in a pipeline in the city or in the middle of a field with a farmer. They got to learn that on their own. So this is why the vocational courses are so important to keep and to continue to grow.
Thank you, Ms. Nordquist. Very well said. You're very articulate. For a junior in high school, we are very proud of you. Welcome, Mr. Carstensen, and tell us your story after you introduce yourself.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. My name is Adam Carstensen. I'm a senior at Fairmont Junior Senior High School, and I am enrolled in the welding courses on Saturday, as well as many others during the week. First off, some background of myself. I have been exposed to many trades as a young age. My dad is a carpenter, and I remember growing up and wanting to be just like him. But when I got to high school, I finally had the chance to do so thanks to the vocational programs. I had taken four welding semesters before my first class at the Saturday welding class, and I remember my first thoughts were thinking of how much I got done in the 4 hours on Saturday. Thanks to this class, I knew for sure that I wanted to go into the trades and have them be a part of my life, so I chose to go to school for welding technology in Alexandria, Minnesota. The weekend welding shop classes are incredibly important to many students because they simply do not have enough time in the normal school day to get these done. I enjoy these welding classes because they offer more time at once to do the task to get done, and with this extra time, you can get bigger tasks done that you would not be able to do otherwise during the normal school day. These classes help me with everything from improving certain welding skills to making custom projects for someone in the community. These classes teach us a lot apart from the subjects that we are learning that I will use for the rest of my life, such as problem solving and people skills. These skills can be developed in other core classes but cannot be used in the same way they are in the shop environment where you are using them everywhere and all the time. In my eyes, I would say that I am the most experienced in my school for welding. I have taken 9 classes in welding, and if I do the math, I've spent over 700 hours in the shop just for welding. With this in mind, I can honestly say that I am still learning skills and techniques daily that I will use later in my career. These shop classes are a big part of the future for our country because these are builders and innovators of the future. The trades, such as plumbing, electrical, carpentry, and construction, etc., can be represented like a chair. You need all 4 legs of the chair for it to work properly. If you are missing a leg, in this case welding, the chair will fall, and you don't have to be a genius to find that this would be bad for our way of life. In the end, welding is a huge part of this chair. Without it, there will be bigger problems in our future. So because of this, I believe that we need to encourage and help move the trades forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Carstensen. My 700 hours is fantastic. I think you could rival any professional out there. Very good. In the audience, we have an alum of Fairmont Area Schools, Andrew Hassick. Give us a wave. He was formerly the committee administrator for this committee. And he's talked many times to me about the successes of Fairmont Area Schools. So we're glad to have him on staff here and have him here supporting you today. Are there questions for the students? Representative Ward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I would like to thank you both for coming and for the teachers and the administrators being here and telling us about your program. people who have been on the committee with me know that I'm a real advocate for vocational education of all sorts, and I particularly wanted to thank Ms. Nordquist for bringing up the life skills aspect, because these are all transferable, regardless of what trade people might go into or what career they might choose beyond the trades. They're life skills, and they are transferable and so useful, and we need people to be able to take care of their own things and know quality when they see it, those kinds of things. So I just want to say thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Ward. Representative Daniels.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. To testifiers, you're looking at an old welder. I started when I was about 8 or 9 years old, and just wonder what your favorite is, either stick welding or wire feed welding, aluminum welding, and then also when you get into all the different types of welding, does the class involve any type of metallurgy? Because I know in the manufacturing business that's a huge thing. So just curious.
Mr. Karstensen?
My favorite welding would be small welding or stick welding. It involves more movement, which I don't like sitting there just moving my hands. I like going all over the place. So,
Ms. Nordquist?
This is this Saturday welding class I'm currently in is only my second one, but so far I do like the challenge of the stick welding. I think that's something, I mean, I'm not very good at it yet, but it's something I can definitely improve on, and I like a good challenge.
Thank you, and I guess we want to hear from Mr. Bonin, too.
Yeah, I'd like to address Representative Daniels. In our class, we do teach metallurgy. They do have to know which metals play fair with each other. And so when we do that, and it's been very fortunate we have our principal, Andy Tradel, comes in. We oftentimes, as we talk about those transfer skills, we talk about how this is a science term. What metals bond together? Which one makes them stronger? What's our tensile strength? And so you have both these. And is not as much as what Adam is with his career. He gets more into that metallurgy. We talk about that stuff all the time. The other interesting thing that they both picked, stick welding, which stands for shielded metal arc welding, we do still teach that down in southern Minnesota because of the farming economy that we have down there. You can't take a MIG welder out to the middle of a field and fix somebody's tractor. Yes, you can have a generator and a rig on the back of a truck, but when it's fall time and they broke down and the wind is blowing 20 miles an hour, that shielding gas goes nowhere. So it's a lost art, but it's still practiced today. So, yes, we do that. So thank you for being a former welder, and we're still out there.
Thank you very much.
So, Representative Daniels, does that mean that we can call on you and we have these little fixes needed?
Madam Chair, the house I live in now, I've got an estimate to put a 230 plug-in into my garage, and I choose not to. My oldest son went to Wilmer for a two-year degree in welding.
Bridgewater.
And so anytime somebody needs welding, I don't have to do that. I've got somebody that I can call upon, and he does an excellent job.
Yeah, that's great.
Thank you.
Are there any other questions for the testifiers? Representative Pryor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And maybe it's for the students, but also the principal, the faculty. Do these classes, do they count towards a certificate program that you would have to show that you are that you're trained and
Mr.
Tredo,
do you want to answer that one?
Absolutely. Yeah, currently our students that are taking courses outside of the regular school, they are generating high school credit for those courses. Just this spring semester, we also added the college and the schools certification to our advanced welding course. So, like right now, Adam is able to take that course for college and the schools credits that he will be able to transfer to Alexandria Technical and Community College right now. So that's been one way that we've expanded that offering in the past. We've just offered an intro to welding course combined with a career welding course. And like I said, this spring semester at our school for the first time, we have partnered with Riverland Community College to offer that as college in the schools credit. So not only are they getting high school credit, they're also have the ability to generate the college credit as well, which only continues to accelerate their advancement in the area of welding.
Thank you, Representative Pryor. Continue.
One last thing, too. With our Saturday Welding Academy, we have those adults that take the class in the summer as well. We have a
certificate
for them that actually works in our Martin County area because we do partner with those local businesses, and they come into our classroom. We actually have a representative from Waytronics, which is a large manufacturing firm in our backyard, has a representative about once a week that comes into our welding class and actually works with the students so they know what our curriculum is as well. It's called Zerke Built Manufacturing. They're from Winnebago, Minnesota originally. Moved to Fairmont as a result of our welding program. And they, too, recognize our workers. In fact, they've hired 7 of our workers over the last 12 months right out of high school. So we do have that certificate that goes to our local people that says we are a graduate of the Fairmont Welding Academy. And so they can take that to the local welders and it gets them. Along with that class we take, we also do a national welding safety certificate as well that the students can earn, and Adam can tell you about that.
That's excellent. Any further question?
And I just to make sure that I'm understanding how the finance part of this and the formula. So it seems
ask
like
a question for finance.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's see who's on finance in that row. Yes, Representative Mariani will be sure he asks about that because we are referring this to K-12 finance. Representative Haley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this may be a question for you, actually, or the author. I just wanted to clarify, are agricultural classes currently covered under this funding formula? We did.
Under the extended time?
Yes.
Well, any course can be considered under extended time if it's in the school day. This is an exception for career and technical because some of their courses are offered on Saturdays or not in the school day. So,
and does the same apply to agricultural classes? I guess I wasn't clear.
Ms. Perry, do you know? Or is Mr. Strom in the audience? Mr. Strom, would you please come forward to the testifying table?
Madam Chair, members. Oh, thank you.
Thank you. Please say your name for the record, Mr.
Madam
Strom.
Madam Chair, members, I'm Tim Strom from House Research. The extended time currently covers career and technical services and classes as long as they're provided through the Area Learning Center or otherwise through a state-approved alternative program, and that puts two restrictions on that would not allow a program like this to qualify. The first of those is that for nearly all of the extended time programs, a person doesn't take the class for enrichment. Instead, the class is for a remedial nature or making up a deficiency. So that's the first problem. The second is that the extended time programs are required to be run through the ALC or the Area Learning Program or some other mechanism like that as part of a state-approved alternative program. So those two are the funding factors that currently limit the application of funding for a program like this. The way the language in Representative Bennett's bill is written, it wouldn't matter if the program were for welding or for agricultural education or for any other program that fits the career and technical definition.
Okay, thank you for that clarification.
Thank you, Representative.
In my district,
thank you,
that's
Mr.
important.
Strom. And if we reread the amendment, then that provides the clarification. Extended time revenue for pupils enrolled in a career and technical education course offered for secondary credit by a high school outside of the regular school day equals membership hours, and then it goes on to the formula. So we'll further debate that in finance, but that clarifies it. Are there any other questions from members? Representative Rarick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In the testimony, we heard you have a woodworking program. Do you have any other courses? You mentioned many different trades.
Superintendent Brown.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Yes, we have a construction trades program, the Welding Academy, small engines, automotive, family and consumer science, and agriculture academy. And because of the new tier licensing, Principal Trado and I, even in August of this year, as soon as new tier licensing, tier one specifically we're talking about, which would allow us to have a teacher who has at least 5 years of experience in the trades can teach a high school class now under the tier one licensing system. And so Principal Trado and I did go and speak to Day Plumbing, which is our large plumbing and HVAC business here in Fairmont, and we also met with Dewar Electric. And Dewar Electric is very interested in doing a summer electrical class, and they'll have their professionals teaching that class. And so, you know, I really think that this is kind of, remember the old Reese's Peanut Butter Cup commercial, putting the chocolate and the peanut butter together? Mm-hmm. By taking the world's best workforce, the new tier licensing system, and the great need that we have in our state of Minnesota for more skilled workers, House File 3190, as amended, will solve a lot of issues. And if you look at the second page of my testimony, I did a cost-benefit analysis of the amount of money it would generate. We'll probably talk about that more at 1 o'clock when we appear in front of the Finance Committee. But it would generate a maximum of $1,228 per student if he or she took at least 3.5 vocational classes outside of the traditional school day each school year. And right now it's costing us about $6,000. So actually costing us about $7,000 a year just to do that summer welding or the Saturday welding class. Our teacher gets $4,000. Our instructional aide gets $2,000. The rest goes to supplies. The point of that story is that this bill will just cover the cost of those extended programs. School district's not going to make any money on this program. But more importantly, Minnesota is going to create more skilled workers. I figure that you know, if $1 million was spent, it would create about 2,000 additional skilled workers each year.
Superintendent Brown, I think you should go on the road and promote this because your concept here is really invaluable for so many school districts, and I'd like to see it expanded. So consider being a marketer of it.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Well, that's more importantly, that's why we're here in front of your committee, because it's your committee and the Finance Committee will make the decision on whether this becomes law as part of the Omnibus Education Act this year. I think it's one of the – it's such a need. It gives me goosebumps. I mean, this will solve a lot of our issues in Minnesota, and I think we, once again, will become a leader across the country, and I want Minnesota to be number one.
Representative Rare, follow-up.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to finish by saying I loved hearing all of this. I'm an electrician, have been for over 20 years. Hopefully it was you were saving the best for last, because nearly everybody said electrician last and all. but, no, I really appreciate this. This has been one of my things I want to work on, programs just like this available to our high school students, exposing them to the opportunities in manufacturing and construction. We have such a need, and we seem to have this emphasis, you got to go to college, you got to go to college. And the demand is out there, and I think listening to our two testifiers, being exposed to it makes them realize that this is maybe something they would enjoy doing. And even if not as a career, it was mentioned, maybe something goes wrong at your house, you don't have to hire somebody to come in and do it, because we maybe all know the wait list that you're on right now to get the skilled trade person to come in and do something at your house. So I really, really loved hearing what you got going on there, and I do hope that other schools can follow. And so, yeah, thank you for everything you're doing there.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Brown.
Representative, after you get reelected in November, you can come down and teach a class for us. You said you have 20 years' experience. You only need 5 to get a Tier 1 license. I would encourage you to do that.
That's right.
I also want to thank the legislature, though, too. You know, when you pass the long-term facility maintenance program for all school districts, we're actually using that in Fairmont. Right now we have Dewar Electric. We signed a $680,000 contract. We're replacing all 5,000 of our fluorescent light bulbs with LED lighting. Mm-hmm. It's a 4-year payback, and then on year 5 we'll start saving us $100,000. Those are the type of bills that when you pass these types of bills, that it really helps not only individual schools, but it helps our taxpayers, because we're making better decisions at the local level, and we're saving money. I mean, isn't it great? That's my theme this year. Isn't it great? So I want to thank you for all serving. I appreciate your time and effort. And can I point out one more thing? The sheet, I hope everybody got my handout, but I want to show you Anna's class schedule real quick. Anna, who's taken 7 classes, I just want to read these off to you. Concert Orchestra, Honors Pre-Calculus, Honors English 11, Advanced Placement Honors Math Statistics College in the Schools, Honors Chemistry College in the Schools, Honors Spanish 3, Advanced Placement World History College in the Schools, and she's taking the Saturday welding class. One of our typical students. Okay.
Yeah, that's a real salute to our children, isn't it? Representative Mariani.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And first of all, let me just say I think Representative Bennett and to our testifiers, I think this committee is totally feeling you know, this idea. And in finance, I think what's going to happen is we're going to get into some more technical questions about not the idea, whether it's a good idea or not, but how do we best cover and pay for that? Mm-hmm. And there's some policies that are connected to each one of our funding sources. There's a purpose behind those. So I'm just kind of, you know, letting you know ahead of time that you may be hearing a slightly different conversation there, but none of that conversation is a rejection of the incredible work that these young people are doing and what your school district is doing with them. And I do appreciate the superintendent earlier, you know, broaching the issue about what the eventual cost, you know, possibilities are and what the cost-benefit analysis of all that. I think that's very helpful. I think Representative Haley's question was really helpful for me in having Mr. Strom come up. And so immediately what I heard was this issue, Madam Chair, and I think it is more finance. It's important for this committee to hear it first, of the shifting from remediation to enrichment. I mean, that's really going to be, I think, at the core. And so maybe my quick question for you, Representative Bennett, and I really don't know, but my quick question for you is, did you consider and look at other possible ways in which to cover these expenses and other parts of the formula? And Madam Chair, we don't have to do this deep here because, again, we'll do it in finance, but I'm just curious if you know, what you can share with us about what you...
Representative Bennett. Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Mariani, I am very open to suggestions. This is something that's pretty new, and I just took the advice of our researchers in how to go about this at this time anyway.
Fair enough.
Thank you very much. Mr. Uni, you did not want to make a comment, did you, from the department? I saw you moving forward, so... thank you, testifiers, very much. We've spent considerable time on this very important bill, and we have others in front of us, so we need to move on. Mr. Uni, please say your name.
Madam Chair, members, Adosh Uni with the Department of Education. I just wanted to make a comment that we would like to work with the author and the stakeholders on, I think, as Representative Mariani was suggesting, some alternatives possibly. I think Mr. Strom had brought up some about the intent of extended time revenue originally. And I think we are open to working with the author. I apologize for not being able to connect earlier, but I know we have a hearing informationally later this afternoon, and so we can possibly connect in the afternoon. I'm still working with staff on coming up with more nuanced comments on the matters, but just wanted to let the committee know that we're looking at the proposals.
With that, Representative Bennett, closing comments.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, isn't this exciting to hear things like this? I love to hear it and watch school districts like the Fairmont District just with their innovative and creative ideas and just meeting the needs of students and also meeting the needs of our workforce and our businesses. So looking forward to continued conversation on this. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Bennett. And the Chair renews Representative Bennett's motion that House File 3190, as amended, be re-referred to the Committee on Education and Finance. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, no. The motion prevails, and the bill is re-referred. Next is House File 318. No, I'm going to change this. Let's go to House File 3207, which is the textbook definition modified. Members, this is my file along with Representative Dabney. Will Ms. Ballmer and others come forward, please? Welcome to our committee. The chair moves House File 3207 to be re-referred to the Committee on Education Finance. Welcome to our committee, members. I think I'm going to let the testifiers basically define or explain what has occurred in regard to non-public students who have access to textbooks, who now have a dilemma because of a policy change among the sellers of educational products. So welcome, Ms. Ballmer. Please say your name for the record and begin.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Karen Ballmer. I have the pleasure of serving as the lower and middle school principal at Minnehaha Academy. We truly thank you for the opportunity this morning. If it's okay with you, Madam Chair, I might defer to my colleague Tim Benz to lead us, and then I'll follow him if that would be okay.
Thank you very much. Mr. Benz, welcome. Say your name for the record and begin.
Good morning. My name is Tim Benz. I am the president of the Minnesota Independent School Forum, and I'm happy to be here with my colleagues from Minnehaha Academy. We're the largest statewide organization representing the non-public schools in the state. Just for context, there's about 460 non-public schools in the state of Minnesota, and they educate approximately 65,000 students. That does not include the homeschool population as well. One area that's been bubbling up across our schools, across the state, is just a little clarification and updating of the textbook portion of the non-public pupil aid program. The program, in existence since 1975, has been a wonderful resource for our schools to ensure students have the necessary resources available to maximize their learning. And since the establishment, several modifications have been made as well. Just to update, ideas would be from videos to cassettes to CDs to electronic textbooks. So throughout the years, there's been many modifications to bring things into current status. Made connections with other states as well, other organizations similar to ours, understanding how these work in other states, and have found modifications similar to what we're asking and requesting within this. As you'll hear from my colleagues as well, a slight change will assist in providing the necessary resources to the teacher and students in the classroom, and I can assure you that the very positive relationships between our schools and the local districts is very healthy, and we're very pleased with that, and the districts are always very accommodating in this. So thank you for the time. We'd like to recognize and thank Representative Erickson and Representative Dabney for bringing this forward, and I am available for questions as necessary.
Thank you, Mr. Benz. Do we have another testifier, Ms. Palmer?
Yes, and I think if I may, I'll insert myself again here for some additional information to build on what Mr. Benz has already shared with you. So as you heard, this is language that has been enacted and in statute for a long time, 1975. It was initially created and established. And what we're here for this morning is a relatively small and technical change to that language, but one that will represent a significant impact for our learners in our non-public schools. So if we go back to that original authorizing language in 1975, the Declaration of Intent, which is largely the same today, stated, "It is the intent of the legislature by this enactment to provide for distribution of educational aids, such as auxiliary services, instructional materials, and equipment, so that every school child in the state will share equitably in education benefits and therefore further assure all Minnesota students and their parents freedom of choice in education." So again, that was original, that's 40 plus years old, and that Declaration of Intent is largely the same in the statute today. So for the last 40 plus years, non-public schools have received support for instructional materials. At Minnehaha Academy, these funds don't cover all of our costs associated with curriculum and materials, but they do represent a significant source of funding for us, and for that, we're deeply grateful. When this authorizing language was enacted, though, as you know, 1975, the world was very different, including resources that were available to schools and children, and most importantly for teachers to support their children in the classrooms. There was no internet at that time, no one-to-one device available. There were no learning management systems as we know them today, and on and on. The statute has been amended at various points in history, as Mr. Benz referred to. So, for example, a provision for CD-ROMs was added in 1996. And then in 2011, most recently, a language was added to include, quote, "electronic books and other printed materials delivered electronically." So we're at another juncture, simply, where the current language does not align with the way that curriculum is being developed and delivered to meet the needs of our learners today in 2018. So as such, we're increasingly unable to access the funds that have already been set aside per this language to support our learners, simply because the language doesn't reflect what we know about our learners today and what the resources look like that we want to put in front of them to maximize their growth and learning. The change that we're proposing does not stray from the original intent of the language before you. It is still fully and centrally about student learning and student materials. This simply allows us to access those materials in today's world of curriculum. So, members of the committee, I thank you very much for your consideration of this change, and I thought it might be helpful for you to hear from one of my colleagues whose world is fully curriculum and instruction, Julie Nguyen. And so if there is an opportunity, I would welcome an opportunity for you to hear from her with some specific examples of this language in action.
Thank you, Ms. Palmer. And members, just to remind you that this bill expands the definition of textbooks to include a teacher's edition or teacher's guide that accompanies the textbook used by a student. It's a new policy that, as I said earlier, educational sellers are now demanding. So welcome to our committee. Say your name and please provide your testimony.
Switch over. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Julie Nguyen, and I serve as the Curriculum and Instructional Specialist at Minnehaha Academy. It is my pleasure to be here with you this morning. More and more often, we are finding that the best materials are inaccessible to us because of the current language of the statutes, which defines learning materials and textbooks. Vendors are now frequently bundling online resources for teachers, which might include lesson plans, assessment tools, enrichment, and reteaching materials, along with student materials. There is no opportunity to unbundle them if we purchase them in this online method. The statute currently restricts us from making these purchases with otherwise available funds that would be provided under that textbook subdivision. In the past year, we've had two instances where we have been unable to purchase desired curriculum because of these limitations. One example was an online science curriculum that we were considering for our Earth Science program as a resource. It presented highly engaging and customizable information up to date, which would meet the needs of our middle school students very well. However, the materials came bundled with teacher materials, which included some assessments and also some modules where teachers could learn how to deliver this online material, these materials, in the best possible way. Because of those inclusions, we were unable to purchase this material. We also faced challenges purchasing our literacy curriculum this last year. We found an excellent resource to use, but because of the student materials and teacher resources that were bundled together, we were unable to use textbook funds to make these purchases. And just to note again, I am in a position where I work directly with these vendors to develop purchasing proposals and work through exactly what we're buying. And I inquired, because I knew that this would be a problem for accessing some of these materials, if we could unbundle and separate out the teacher material in some way. And there was no opportunity for us to do that. It's the way that they're designed for delivery online. It's just they're programmed or they're written differently, and they can't separate those things out. So, Madam Chair and members of the committee, the materials I was just describing to you are the kind of resources that every student should have access to and every educator worth their salt would want to offer to their students. And let me also add that these are cost-effective. Online delivery of materials saves vendors millions in printing and binding and delivery fees, which shows up on our bottom line for purchasing, saving us thousands of dollars each year. They also are updated regularly in real time, which means materials do not become out of date as quickly, which is another reason why we need to repurchase or supply our teachers with better resources. Not only does the statute on the books now limit us from accessing the best materials, but it's costing us more to use the current language. It would be more cost effective for us to move to a different way of thinking about that. So we sincerely hope that you support the change in language. We believe it would allow greater freedom in our curricular selection and allow students access to the most current and modern resources and be more cost effective than the current model. So thank you for this consideration.
Thank you very much. I think that we have a concern from the department. So Mr. Uni, if you would come forward, Ms. Balmer and Mr. Ben Stay, and express your concerns, and then we'll have questions from members if they have. Welcome again, Mr. Uni.
Good morning. Again, my name is Doch Uni. I'm Director of Government Relations at the Department of Education. Madam Chair, members, I've been in contact with obviously the author and with the representative of the advocates just about the mechanics of it and the concerns of the department going forward. I think it's just generally philosophically we have some concerns about, you know, the theory of the child, that the benefits of the Mon public aid should go directly to the child, whether it be textbook and materials, transportation funding, special education services, or EL services. We do keenly recognize the reality of the packaging of the materials do come together from the companies, recognize that there is, you know, their efficiency of purchasing the materials together. However, within the context of the theory of the and the intent of the original legislation around the non-public student aid, the money should be directly directly channeled towards materials, textbooks that are directly used for the benefit of the student and by the student.
Thank you, Mr. Uni. Teachers are
pretty important, though, in the dissemination of information to students. So I see them as being kind of one and the same. Mr. Rooney.
Yeah, Madam Chair, and I recognize that it is a fine line and a gray area at the same time. We do recognize that, but on advice from staff, this is the way we are interpreting the intent of the original legislation.
Are there questions from members? Mr. Representative Mariani.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Mr. Rooney, and Ms. Palmer, it's good to see you again. You're in a very good place at Minnehaha. Glad to see that. I sort of struggle with this. I mean, I think it's critically important to get on the record what Mr. Rooney just shared. It's my opinion, I know we're not in total agreement in this legislature on this at any given point in time, but in my opinion, I think our state has struck a very smart, commonsensical, good balance in terms of this issue of public support for different learning environments. And so there's a broad choice in this state. And I have long supported this particular statute in terms of the state making these investments in student textbooks. I do get the issue that Mr. Rooney is putting before us, and I don't think we should lightly go over that. We should wrestle with that issue, in my opinion. It does strike me, however, that textbook, quote unquote, is essentially being redefined by the marketplace. And so I find some comfort there, you know, in terms of that. I'll continue to wrestle with this, but I think generally, now, folks like me have been very supportive of this type of support that we provide for students in our private schools. So anyway, I just want to get that out in the record. I think it's important not to gloss over it, for sure, wrestle with that delicate and fine balance that I think we've struck at this state, which I think makes us very unique and very powerful in terms of providing opportunities for all students. So. Yeah, I mean, the marketplace is going to constantly shift and throw, you know, curveballs at us, and so that's one of the curveballs they throw at us. But thank you for coming forward, and thank you, Madam Chair, for bringing us this bill to wrestle with.
Mr. Benz, any comment to that?
Madam Chair, Representative Mariani, thank you very much. I can tell you specifically, just talking with a number of our schools, the resources provided through this program are gratefully received and accepted, and you know, at the end of the day, I think they have always thought about, and to your point is, you know, always looking about all these students are really important to everything that we do in the state, and it's a wonderful program, and we are very much appreciative.
Any other questions or concerns to come forward? Anyone in the audience other than our very needed Mr. Uni as a resource? Okay, members, with that, the chair will summarize this change in the non-public textbook definition that expands it to include a teacher's edition or teacher's guide that accompanies the textbook used by the student. And that is because of this bundling issue that we have. And so not to provide any disservice to our students in the non-public area, the chair renews her motion that 3207 be referred to the Committee on Education Finance. All those in favor say aye. 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 Those opposed, no. The motion prevails, and the bill is re-referred. Thank you very much, Ms. Baumer and Mr. Benz, and your other testifier. With that, we move to House File 3182. Another bill of the chairs. Members, I will move House File 3182. To be re-referred to the Committee on Education Finance. This is a bill about a transportation issue in regard to homeless that has arisen, and it's something that we have to clarify in law. So members, a pupil transportation authority is signed for homeless students, and then it's going to have some money behind it in finance if it proceeds. But it is important that we ensure that our homeless children can also be transported. So with that, We have some good testifiers today, Ms. Hayes and Mr. Strack. So I'm going to call on you, Ms. Hayes, to introduce yourself. Welcome, and then explain the need for this.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Connie Hayes. I'm superintendent of Northeast Metro 916 Intermediate District, and I'm here in support of House File 3182. My school district offers specialty services like special education, area learning centers, and vocational education to 14 member school districts in the suburbs of St. Paul. I want to tell you the story about a real student, although I've changed his name. I'll call him Victor, who is a homeless student from one of our member districts. Victor was recently referred to one of our elementary programs at 916 from one of our member districts. I'll call this District 1. The student has experienced long-term homelessness and has been highly mobile. His mom was finally able to get into a shelter located in another school district. I'll call this District Number 2. Despite the change in housing for this student, District 1 determined that the student badly needed the support that 916 could provide her son. So in working with District 2, where the shelter was located, it took 3 days to get transportation set up for that student. Then there was an unintended glitch on the first day of transportation, so that added another day, a fourth day of missed school. Well, then the family found out they needed to move to another shelter, which was in yet another school district, which I will call District Number 3. It took 2 days for District 1 to connect with the representative in District 3 to set up the transportation, and then an additional 5 days to get the student's transportation all coordinated. The student ended up missing 11 days of school. As you can see, when homeless children and families have transitioned, like Victor's family, the likelihood that there will be significant interruptions in school attendance multiply. The students who attend programs at 916 specifically are already vulnerable due to their mental health needs, high medical needs, a disability, autism, and sometimes all of the above. When these students also experience homelessness, it compounds their vulnerability. This bill is intended to make the system work better for these students so that they do not experience the kind of interruptions like Victor simply because he is homeless. Thank you for your consideration of this bill and in support of these students.
Thank you very much, Ms. Hayes. Members, I actually had a situation in my district, which is why I'm carrying this proposal, where a student was attending one of my special education cooperatives, and this dilemma occurred, and the students, as Ms. Hayes said, end up missing so much school as all of this is figured out, and it was just a tragic that this child was denied that opportunity to have his daily needs met. Mr. Strack, welcome. Please say your name for the record and begin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ryan Strack with Minneapolis Schools. I coordinate services for homeless students. I'm also here representing my colleagues in other districts, none of whom wanted to have to explain this complicated piece in front of a group, so I will try my best to do so very succinctly, and I do want to thank the Chair for supporting this. As Superintendent Hayes pointed out, this is really a product of the way the statute is interacting and essentially assigning responsibility for transportation of these students to the resident district, which inherently for homeless students changes frequently. This bill would instead assign that responsibility to the district which initially placed the student into the intermediate program, which is a fixed known quantity. So superintendent's staff would simply need to contact that one district each time the family moves, hopefully then cutting down on the transportation delays and missed school days. So I hope that was succinct enough. We're happy to stand for questions and, again, appreciate the support.
Members, any question? Representative Mariani.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have to say I like the student-centered focus of the bill. I think we share that. I believe all of us share that in common here. Just a quick question. Under the proposed changes then, so I understand the continuity. But the continuity then runs through the remainder of that school year, as I understand it. So what happens then into the next school year, assuming that there's a new residency? Does that then just repeat itself all over again, or is that initial school district under this proposal continuing then to have that commitment going forward?
Mr. Strack.
Madam Chair, Representative Mariani, the way we serve all other homeless students who are not in intermediate or special ed co-ops is that in accordance with the federal McKinney-Vento Act, the student would have the right to stay at that school for the duration of their homelessness and for the remainder of the year if they find housing. The thing about the students addressed in this bill would be that they all have an IEP, and all of these involved districts would need to have a meeting over the summer to determine programming going forward and then decide which district makes the most sense to transport. The remainder of the year is meant to prevent something from changing mid-school year.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Strack. So, closing comments, members. This is a good way to clarify law. I have some notes here, so I want to review those with you. This is a fix that is needed for just, you know, not a large number of students, but those who attend intermediates or cooperatives, so that we know what the resident district is and we can figure out the transportation and the cost that surrounds it. So I think with that clarification, hopefully we will have a better pathway. But I think I see Minnesota School Boards Association. Did you want to comment on this? Oh, no. Okay. I saw movement out there, so I always have to be alert to that. So members, with that said, the chair renews her motion that House File 3182 be re-referred to the Committee on Education and Finance. Those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? And the motion prevails, and the amendment is, the bill is on its way. Then that leads us to our last bill and our growing policy bill from the governor, which I'm carrying and which will eventually become the vehicle for our policy bill. So this will be even a larger bill when it leaves here in a couple of weeks. Welcome to the committee, staff from MDE. The chair will move House File 3315 to be laid over for possible inclusion as, of course, the vehicle. So it's not inclusion. It will be the vehicle. Members, we have two amendments, and I'm glad we're going to get started on the amendments before we have to recess and reconvene. The first amendment, members, that the chair will move is the A180588. And, Mr. Uni, I think you're going to explain that for us, because this is the really substantive amendment that has come as a result of, or Mr. Partey, as a result of our work on school safety and the conversation that the commissioner and I had in regard to some of what may occur or has occurred in our districts that we want to ensure is handled very professionally and very appropriately for the student and for the school. So, members, I'm going to ask Mr. Cordy to identify himself. Welcome, please, and to tell us the substantive nature of 0588.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Darren Cordy. I'm an assistant commissioner at the Minnesota Department of Education. Thank you, first of all, for carrying the bill as well as this amendment. As you heard in the governor's press conference yesterday, you know, one of the main components of his thrust to keep schools safe is for us to provide additional supports to those students who may need it, who may be falling behind, and who, for one reason or another, may be in a situation where they might be expelled, dismissed, or withdrawing from school. So I will walk through this amendment, starting with Section 1. Under current law, districts are required to transfer educational records that include information about student expulsion, student dismissals, or student formal suspensions. So what this would do would to add, if there was a pupil withdrawal agreement, which I'll explain a little bit more in detail, but basically where the district and the student agreed to withdraw rather than expulsion proceedings moving forward, that would also be included in these student records. as well as any information about a school threat assessment, which, again, I'll talk about later, but this just expands what records would be transferred when a student moves between districts. So moving on to Section 3, which is on page 2, line 13, this creates a definition of non-exclusionary disciplinary policies and practices. This language may look familiar to you. There is a bill in the Senate. It's Senate File 2920 that is being carried by the chair's counterpart, Chair Pratt, who the bill is being supported, I understand, by the Solutions Not Suspensions Coalition. We thought there were some good things in that bill, including this definition. So this language is similar to their language, but it basically defines it as alternatives to removing a pupil from class or dismissing a pupil from school. And then it goes on to explain a number of examples, including academic, social, and mental health supports. It also requires that school officials would intervene and redirect a pupil's behavior before moving on to removing a school from class or beginning dismissal proceedings. Section 4 on line 2.29 creates a definition for a school threat assessment. This definition comes from the U.S. Department of Education as well as the United States Social Secret Service. This is a definition that's used pretty much universally across the states and is used by the School Safety Center at the Department of Public Safety. So this defines it as a fact-based process with a team approach, but we also want to make sure that we're emphasizing that we're not just looking at the threat, but also the services that would be needed to address the pupil's underlying issues that led to that situation. On Section 5, on 3.6, we create a definition for pupil withdrawal agreements. As I discussed before, probably about a decade ago, we had about 300 expulsions a year. We're down to about 100. Now, we know that part of that is because of positive supports and interventions that are preventing expulsions, but we also know that there are these pupil withdrawal agreements that we're not necessarily tracking right now, and this is, again, where a district and a parent would agree to withdraw the student rather than there being a formal expulsion, which would then be a part of that student's educational record and would kind of follow them around. So this creates a definition for what those are. Section 6, under current law, there's a requirement to provide alternative educational services before dismissing a pupil. We expand that to include non-exclusionary disciplinary policies, which was defined before, and includes those alternative educational services. And we also add the pupil withdrawal agreements to that as well. So prior to entering into a pupil withdrawal agreement, you need to try and use some of those non-exclusionary disciplinary policies. Section 7 on 3.21 creates a requirement that when a pupil is suspended for more than 5 consecutive school days, that alternative educational services are provided, and there's already a definition in statute for what those services are. Section 8 on 3.27 requires that a suspended pupil be given the opportunity to complete all of the schoolwork that is assigned to them during the pupil suspension. Again, this is a part of the Senate file that I mentioned earlier, and it also encourages districts to designate a liaison that would work with that student when they're no longer in school to ensure that they're receiving their course materials and completing daily and weekly assignments. Section 9 on 4.7 creates a requirement for doing a school threat assessment, as was defined earlier, as part of the exclusion, expulsion, or pupil withdrawal process. So prior to providing notice of expulsion or agreeing to withdrawal, you have to do this threat assessment. And, again, we're making sure that it's addressing the pupil's underlying issues as well as just looking at the threat in general. On Section 10, again, we're just expanding on 4.23, expanding the definition there of alternative educational services to that non-exclusionary policies, which includes that. On Section 11, which is starts on line 5.4, there's currently a requirement for an admission and readmission plan that under current law, it's a may there that they include measures to improve student behavior. We're changing that to a must, but then leaving the discretion to the districts on what those measures look like. On Section 12, on page 5.27, this adds pupil withdrawal agreements to the disciplinary incident reporting system that we currently have at the Department of Education. This is kind of a blind spot that we have in that system where we're not collecting this information. We think that by collecting that information and reporting it out to you and to the public, that will give us a more complete picture of disciplinary proceedings across the state. And then on Section 13, starting on line 6.7, school districts are required to have a school discipline policy, and this just clarifies that they have to include non-exclusionary disciplinary policies and practices consistent with that definition earlier in that policy, and that the policy must include a plan to track student academic progress during the expulsion. And that student, if there are school-linked mental health services available in that district, that the student continues to be available, those services continue to be available to that student while they are expelled, excluded, or withdrawn until they enroll in another district. And then lastly, on page 7, there's a requirement that districts provide a list of available mental health services to parents, and this should be something that they can easily get from their local county. So that is the amendment, Madam Chair. I'd be happy to stand for any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Corday. Are there questions for Mr. Corday? Representative Kunesh-Badin.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you. I have a couple of questions here. When they back on the pupil withdrawal agreement, when a student is moves from one school to the next, is the school that it's that the student is moving to, are they notified? Or are they aware of the reason that the student has and the family has entered into that agreement?
Mr. Cordy.
Madam Chair and Representative Kunesh-Badin, under current law, that's not the case. So that's kind of what we're trying to do with that section. One is that if there was a pupil withdrawal agreement that was done in lieu of an exclusion or an expulsion, then the reasons for that would need to be documented and transferred as part of the student's educational records. But that's not what currently happens.
Okay. And then down on in Section 12 when it says the school board must report through the department electronic reporting system each exclusion or expulsion, each physical assault of a district employee by a pupil, and each pupil withdrawal agreement within 30 days of the effective date and dismissal withdrawal. So they report it to the school board, and then what?
Mr. Cordy.
Madam Chair, Representative Kunesh-Badin, it gets reported to the Department of Education. We have an electronic reporting system that they submit that information to, and then we aggregate that data, report it out publicly on our website, and then it's also included as part of a legislative report that we give. Okay.
And Representative Kunesh-Badin, I have requested, based on this statute, that they do provide us with that information that now they have to collect.
And, okay. And then one more question,
yes, please.
All right. And then over here under, start on 6.16?
Okay.
The school is responsible to ensure the alternative education services. The other services. What if that child is open enrolled in another school district? Then who's responsible for that? Would they go back to their own school district or the district that they are currently enrolled in?
Mr. Cardi.
Madam Chair and Representative, this would be, so this is a policy that would exist for the student, for the district in which the student was enrolled. So if the student was open enrolled into a different district, then it would be the responsibility of that district when they enroll. But if there's an expulsion or an exclusion or a pupil withdrawal and there's kind of a gap there between the enrollment, the school that did the exclusion would be responsible for providing those services until the student was enrolled in another district.
Okay. Thank you very much.
You're
welcome. Representative Ward.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Mr. Cordy. This may be a question for Ms. Pera, and I apologize for not being familiar enough with this, but line 2.32. References an integrated team approach. I had some students not from my district visit me yesterday, and they had some really great ideas about school safety. Maybe we can talk about that another time. But I'm wondering, is it identified what an integrated team is, who's required to be involved? Because I thought these students really need to be involved.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Cordy.
Madam Chair and Representative Ward, there are resources that the Department of Public Safety presents on this, on what that integrated team would look like. We don't define it in this statute because we want districts to have that flexibility to add members as they see fit to meet their community, but I do agree that student voice would be very important in what that team would look like.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Ward. The School Safety Center, in their presentation in finance, alluded to that, but not specifically. So thanks for bringing it up. Are there other questions for members? Because our time is getting close here. So members, the chair renews her motion that the A180588 be adopted to House File 3315. All those in favor say aye. Aye. Those opposed, no. The motion prevails, and the amendment has been adopted. So, members, we'll continue with 3315 at the call of the chair, or about 4:15. We are scheduled to have a short floor session, so this committee stands in recess. Members, it is room 5. I'm sorry. I think I'll announce that on the floor, so please listen.
And we should leave our folders.
Yes, leave everything intact. Put it back in your folders for this particular bill, 3315. It has another amendment. Education Innovation Policy reconvenes at a little after 4:15, but not yet 4:16. Thank you, everyone, for returning. What we're going to start with is expression of concerns in regard to the amendment that we adopted at the end of the morning session. So concerns about any of the content of the A180588, and we'll begin with Mr. Arnson. Welcome to our committee. Please say your name for the record and begin.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Roger Arnson, and I represent the Elementary and Secondary Principals Association, and appreciate the opportunity to make a couple of comments to the committee as you're going through your policy journey on the A18 and other discipline pieces that come through here. And I really do want to express some, I like when you phrase it, concerns. We appreciate the governor's efforts to make schools safer. I think we all agree on that. We just need to be careful and on behalf of the school principals as we move through this that we don't rush to judgment and do some things that maybe we don't want to do or that go farther or not far enough. But just a couple of things. First of all, the amendment incorporates a new concept in statute. It's something that exists in practice in some places, but it is this threat assessment. We adopt a definition of threat assessments relative to students, and then we say that this is a fact-based process with an integrated team approach. That's on page 2 in section 4. I think what we need to think a little bit about here is as we create data relative to kids to say we've conducted a threat assessment about you, that may have some negative long-term consequences relative to kids. We might want to talk about that, you know, before we get too deep into it, of generating these records. I mean, the bill says, you know, if you create them, transfer them to other school districts. And I think you're going to have some parents who say, wait a minute, I'd like to be involved in, is there a threat assessment, you know, relative to my child? Is that done pursuant to some protocols or standards? And how long do those records exist once the school has them? Obviously, we have some statutory processes for expungement and that sort of stuff, but I don't think those are particularly good remedies. The other side of that is once we create this standard, we don't say that all schools have to do them, but there probably is some risk for those districts that don't. When an event occurs, as tragic as that may be, and then it is, did the school district do a threat assessment? And so it's something we really should talk about quite a bit. We would say, and sketch out some protocols, you know, relative to these to really protect everybody on it. I can tell you, I was thinking about this. If my clients came and said, members of the committee, we've got a great new bill. We want to do threat assessments on kids, and we're going to create these records. I don't think I'd get a real warm reception, and I think you'd send me off to see Representative Scott to talk about this in the data committee. So anyway, just those are classic concerns that we want you to think about as you're doing this. One of the a very good concept, but this is in Section 3 of the bill, and probably the most important to school principals, this language defines a list of non-exclusionary disciplinary principles, and if you read that together with Section 6, which appears on 3.14, This language says that we must use non-exclusionary disciplinary policies and practices before we commence dismissal proceedings. And what the goal here is to say, do other things before you suspend kids. That actually is a very good idea, but there are some times when, if we had a group of principals here to talk to you, they would say, there are some times when we need to suspend the child. Just doing restorative justice isn't going to be enough for whatever reason. And we'd like to talk to you about that as we move along. I mean, we think the language should say the school must consider and, where appropriate, implement restorative justice or non-exclusionary discipline. If you make this a one-size-fits-all, that's rather problematic. There was some very good testimony in the other body on Tuesday from St. Paul Johnson High School, and I had the opportunity to talk to the principal there this morning, They have an extensive restorative justice program there. They've reduced their suspensions at the school by 50%. But the program costs $170,000 a year. It's a 1.5, you know, FTE complement to do that. If we move to the mandate to do this everywhere and we don't create some funding for those programs, this is going to be a problem for us. And I raise that. We would suggest that you give us a bit of discretion when we're going to implement these. Let's do some pilots. Let's put some money in and say, here's what works. Here's what the staffing should be. And as we say, that St. Paul Johnson program and the principal there, Michael Thompson, he actually says this does a very good job. They have a full-time restorative justice coordinator, and he works with advanced programming with students. That's what the governor's trying to get to here. But just doing the mandate without doing the program and giving us some discretion is somewhat problematic. Then the last piece I just want to raise with you is this discussion about student withdrawal agreements. And we're going to codify in the statute here that when a district enters into an agreement to have a student withdraw, that now we have to generate some data on that and we have to report that to the department so they can track them. And Mr. Corte told you this morning that this is a blind spot and we want to know more about these agreements. And that may be, what I would say, and we had this discussion with the authors and the other body, is this something you want to know or is this something you need to know? Very often the child engages in some inappropriate behavior and we do say to them, we could go to an expulsion hearing. Here's what happens, and just as a bit of background, and I think this is good for the committee to hear, you've heard this before, but we don't actually do the expulsion in the sense that you all think it is in Minnesota schools, because there's language in the Pupil Fair Dismissal Act, and there are court cases that say that even if we've expelled the child, the district has the continuing obligation to provide services to the child. That really has rendered expulsion largely meaningless. That was the standard in special ed as a result of federal law, and we have extended that to everybody else. So very often the district says, if you're going to go through an expulsion hearing, we're going to have to provide you services. You're going to either be online, you're going to be homeschooled, you're going to go to the area learning center, you could open enroll somewhere else, but you're going to get educational services. If you want to access those services and we won't go through the expulsion hearing, there won't be a record of it, that won't follow you, that's fine with us too. We don't view that as a bad thing. We don't think it's a bad thing that there isn't a record somewhere that this child, you know, left the district to go somewhere else as a result of some disciplinary matter. The only limitations on open enrollment is if the child has formally been expelled for drugs, weapons, or criminal assault. Those provisions are rarely enforced because we rarely go to hearings on these matters. I think we're down to formally under 300 expulsions a year in Minnesota. And I say most of those are just more of a formality than anything else, Madam Chair. So we'd be interested in talking about that language in there as well, you know, as we go on. And if you have us do it on all of these pieces, I want to say we'll do them. You know, that's our job. You're going to make the policy. So part of my job here today is just to say, we want you to make that in an informed fashion, that it's good policy that's going to serve kids, you know, and people in the schools well in the long term. So, Madam Chair, I really do appreciate the opportunity to talk to you about this. I know you know that my other clients are the Minnesota State High School League. We're happy to say we're running a very fine tournament down the block here this weekend. We had wrestling last weekend. We have girls basketball sectional finals right now, in addition to hockey and girls basketball next week. And we talk about this discipline stuff. It's easy to forget sometime all of the really good things that happen in schools. And I think the governor's effort here is to try to make those better, and we appreciate that. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd answer any questions, Mike.
Thank you, Mr. Aronson. Are there any questions? Yes. Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Aronson, you know, I don't mean to dispute things, but in terms of this very fine tournament you're running down the block, I think you got the scores mixed up in one of the games last night. I can't believe that it said Orinal 6, Litchfield 1. It must have been the other way around.
I will be looking into that, Madam Chair. Representative Erdahl, I'm sure we can accommodate that. We could give you a goal or two extra, and that'd be just fine.
Representative Erd, I'll shame on you. Bargaining away a score that was won. Thank you, Mr. Arson.
Thank you, Madam.
Representative Mariani has a question for you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I'll switch you back to your MESP hat. Several things. One is that thank you for the heads up on the threat assessment piece. I didn't thought about it from that perspective. And I do recall Commissioner Corte talking about that is a framework that came from USDOE and Secret Service.
Yes.
I've been here a long time. I've never heard a reference to Secret Service. But it does lead me to believe that there are perhaps some standards out there that we can look at as we take your advice under consideration. And so hopefully the department is listening to that so that we might be armed with what that means. But let me just quick question. So on the Section 3, I'm actually a little disappointed in the perspective here, quite frankly, because I don't think that if the choice is whether it comes down to the school pays or the students pay, I get that the school pays, potentially financially, but, the kids pay, as a result of not having options before them. That does concern me, so you and I should probably visit a little bit about that. And perhaps there might be some ways in which the condition, a school, having an option here. But it seems to me that the restorative practice work, and we don't have a ton of time today to do this, but it seems to me that that's mostly upfront cost. So I've been involved with one of our schools in St. Paul in restorative practice, and quite frankly, there's a lot of really important training that needs to happen up front. Our hope is that, and expectation is that once that's done, you've got another cultural set of behaviors that are now happening within the school that don't require, a constant presence of outside professionals, if you will, training and guiding and restorative practice. So let's visit on that. And then on the other piece, the student withdrawal agreement, what I thought I heard Commissioner Corte imply or say that there has been some kind of move in recent years to doing more of these. Can you tell me whether there's been a trend in the last 5-10 years in terms of moving toward student withdrawal agreements happening across the state?
Mr. Arnson.
Madam Chair, Representative Mariani, I think the answer to that's yes. I think if you look through the expulsion statute,
yes,
an expulsion procedure is a heavily laden due process procedure that really, if the district's going to do it, you almost have to hire outside counsel. So for small rural districts, you're talking $10,000 to run one of these a discharge hearing where we know what the result's going to be. I mean, by and large, the student's educational program is going to be changed. I think everybody has, as a practical matter, short-circuited that particular process and said, let's talk about the alternative education programming you're going to get rather than going through the discharge hearing. So I think that's been very common. I don't think that what the statute gets to is are these written documents that signed by the parties. That's relatively rare. The statute has two components to it. It has expulsion and then it has exclusion. Expulsion is an action to prevent further enrollment. Exclusion is to prevent re-enrollment. So usually what the school district says is, take your program online, do your, we're going to educate you through the area learning center or alternative learning center or an alternative program that we may have. And we're not talking about special ed kids here. We're talking about regular ed kids. In the event you tried to re-enroll in our regular program, we would run the exclusion hearing, and we can do that for up to a year from the event. I mean, that's how it really, I think that's practically how it happens, and I do talk to principals routinely about this as, you know, as they step through these events.
Well, and Madam Chair, Mr. Harrison, I'll dig around a little bit more on this. I can tell you, I think, for me as a legislator, to know at least in a quantified way, you know, what the movement has been in the state generally, and perhaps even regionally, you know, maybe cutting it through some other demographic, you know, rubrics, it would be important for me to know. I don't think I need to know all the details, and maybe that's part of what you're also saying. And then the final thing I'll say, and I've known you for a long time, so I don't think you meant this the way it came out, but you know,
I hate that introduction.
I'm setting you up here. So this, you know, the dispelling, you know, it's not meaningless. It is meaningful if a student is being removed from the learning environment, because part of learning is a collective, you know, social thing, right? And so I think what you were referring to was continued access to some kind of, you know, constant academic, you know, opportunity. But I do think we need to be really careful because with the language and also obviously with the policy, because education, I think many of us would argue, is both and, you know, it is an academic pursuit and a socialization pursuit. And so, but like I said, I've known you for a long time. I don't think you meant what I'm implying here, but I'm just, you know, speaking generally about keeping in mind, you know, the importance and why, in fact, you know, the issue of, you know, removing from a learning environment is important for a whole number of reasons. There's the immediate, perhaps, physical safety reasons, but then there's also the lost opportunity for a proper guidance in the socialization growth of a student.
Madam Chair, just one comment on that, and just so I'm clear, I couldn't agree with you more. What I was saying is, actually going through the legal expulsion hearing, that doesn't have a lot of meaning, you know, relative to the kid. The school doesn't get much from that, and the student doesn't get much from that. I mean, the decision's made that the student engaged in some egregious conduct that says he can't be in this setting anymore as a regular ed kid, so how do we move him to that other setting? And if we can do that cooperatively, rather than putting them through a relatively legalistic confrontation of witnesses, cross-examination piece, you know, and school board motions, that's what I'm saying, is that I don't know that that part of the process is particularly helpful when we're very certain of what the outcome is, Madam Chair. I appreciate your indulgence.
Mr. Anderson, fair enough. Thank you for that clarification.
Well, we always do better, Mr. Chair, Representative Mariani and I thrash these things out. Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair.
And we will as well, Mr. Arnson. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam.
Is there anyone else who would like to address the content of the A18 amendment? Seeing no one coming forward, let's move to the other amendment.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Uni, I'm sorry.
Director of Government Relations at the
Department of Education. Thank you. Welcome and proceed.
Madam Chair, thank you, members. You know, we always welcome the testimony of our partners in the education field. It only helps enrich the conversation and help us enrich our proposals board. But I just, you know, for the sake of the committee, just a few points in response to what Mr. Aronson had pointed out, and hopefully this will help us in our continued dialogue. On the point of the new idea of the threat assessment, yes, this would newly codify a responsibility that we would want our districts to engage in. Our professional staff feels that a lot of districts are engaging in this, obviously not at a consistent level, and I think that's what Mr. Aronson was, one of the issues was pointing to, and it's a strong opinion, you know, of the department and the governor that all districts should be engaging in this when there's a decision around exclusion, expulsion, or a student withdrawal. And I think there may have been a point that you know, aside from the long-term consequences to the child with the name on it, that there may be some consequences of some liability if a district doesn't engage in it when they could have called for it. The statute does require all districts, or the proposed statute does require all districts to engage in this. You know, there's many other requirements along throughout statute that requires districts to engage in certain processes and procedures in reaction to certain situations, and this would just add to that. So I just would note that for the committee that it's quite clear that it is of the district's responsibility to conduct the threat assessment. With the added responsibilities that our proposal provides for districts to enhance school safety and to work with our students and counsel the servant, the students, yes, the funding isn't there in this proposal right here, but as we remember, the governor yesterday did propose a funding package for safe schools under the safe schools levy, and a portion of that levy can be used for counseling and social work, which we feel would be allowable under a threat assessment team work. It's an integrated approach, and we would imagine that districts would be employing licensed professionals who do have who are licensed to do counseling and social work. And so there would be funding there to provide a lot of these services. Under the non-exclusionary disciplinary principles, and it may be having to do restorative justice practices and engaging in alternative services before committing the procedures for dismissal, there is, we still leave on line 3.18, if you refer to the amendment, there still is the remaining language that they don't have to engage in those processes if before the dismissal or disciplinary proceedings, where it appears that the pupil will create an immediate and substantial danger to self or surrounding property. So that safe, you know, that safety measure is still exists, and we understand that that's a very important tool for districts when the student does present an immediate danger to their peers as well as to themselves. And then just on the data on pupil withdrawal, you know, the point that Mr. Aronson is making is well taken around what follows the student. We understand that, but we feel that it's important to include these pupil withdrawals within our proposal because this package is really about the enhanced services that districts need to be providing all of their students that are leaving the school setting. Right now, there is an expectation that for exclusion and expulsion, the districts provide alternative education services. We found that that's not as consistently implemented as we would like. We're obviously making that much clearer for the exclusion and expulsion, but we'd also like to include that responsibility when it comes to pupils that have been that are voluntarily withdrawing, that the districts have that responsibility ongoing.
Thank you, Mr. Ernie. Are there any questions for Mr. Ernie? Representative Mariani.
Thank you. Madam Chair, Representative Rudy, I think you were conferring with your colleague prior when I was in conversation with Mr. Aronson, but I did note that Mr. Corti had, referenced USDOE and Secret Service in terms of threat assessment concepts, frameworks. I'm not quite sure. And it suggests to me that there perhaps might be some standards and helpful elements there that would be helpful for us to look at if, in fact, part of what we want to make sure is that there are some protocols, standards that are consistent, and not only consistent, but consistent with our values as a Minnesota legislature. And so perhaps that's information that at some point you can provide to us.
Mr. Madam Chair, Representative Mariani, that is a fair point, and that's information that we can work with our team at the department to bring forward so the committee and the legislature is more informed about what best practices are out there with this, what would be a new requirement.
Thank you. Are there any others in the audience who would like to testify? Representative Bly, you had a question for
thank you.
The testifier.
Well, I just wanted some clarity. When you mention alternative educational services or alternative, I'm just wondering if you can define that for me. My concern is that we talk about alternative programs or area learning centers, and although those are included in an array of possibilities for an alternative answer to education, they're not the only things that a district might, and they may not be the most appropriate thing for a student. And something that's kind of a long protected part of this is that alternative programs and area learning centers are considered programs of choice, and it's a fine point, perhaps. I just want to make sure that we don't have the sense that any student that we want to push into that kind of program is going to go there, but that we really considered what are the best options and included the student in that and parents in that decision about what's best.
Madam Chair, Representative Byde, that's a great point. Really what the proposal is doing is kind of two sets of alternative procedures or alternative services, if you will. Mm-hmm. The first is we're naming non-exclusionary disciplinary policies, which is a wide array of or a menu of options that the district can consider before going into exclusion, expulsion, or withdrawal procedures. And that includes, if we look up in 2.15 through 2.17, a range of components to counseling services, schooling, mental health services, social emotional services, just to name a few. The other set is after exclusion, expulsion, or withdrawal, when the student is not placed in another school yet, or the parents don't find another placement, they don't get into another formal setting, the district would have a responsibility to give the opportunity to the student to complete all the work, to have quarterly check-ins with the student about the work that they're completing, as well as connections with the parents on a regular basis to assure that they have access to that they're making progress, and hopefully one would come along with helping the parents seek alternative settings.
Thank you. That clarifies for me.
And Representative Y, you'll notice on lines 4.2 and 4.3 that there's encouragement to designate a district or school employee as the liaison to work with the pupil's teachers to allow the suspended pupil to receive timely course materials. So perhaps that would be an avenue to find the right fit.
Sure. Thank you. Yeah.
Thank you. That was a good question, though, and great concern. No others want to come forward with concerns? We have another question. Oh, Representative Makeway.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this could be either for the department, and you might be able to answer it as well. If a student is suspended and they're on an IEP and they're receiving this coursework, how does the IEP fit into the coursework that they're receiving or completing if they're suspended?
Mr. Uni.
Madam Chair, Representative Makeway, that is a great question. I can't speak.
Vote is planned, please.
Yes. I can't speak to the specifics of the interactions there. I know he would be able to provide that answer for you. I'd be more than happy to go back and provide detailed information on that for you.
Yeah, please have that available when we hear this bill again.
Yeah.
Thank you. I think then we'll proceed to the other amendment. This is the 818-0586, and I will move that. This is some changes in school accountability, proficiency that does not work any longer, according to the commissioner, with our new ESSA plan. So, Ms. Snyder, are you here to discuss this amendment?
Correct.
Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Caitlin Snyder. I'm with the Minnesota Department of Education. So there's a fair amount of language in the A180586 amendment, which is very catchily named, but it's all relating to the same concept. So Minnesota has a state statute that outlines low, medium, and high growth, which is in statute 120B.299. And this amendment would have that stricken from state statute, as well as a number of related provisions located in 120B.35 and 120B.36. So the definition of low, medium, and high growth was put into state statute in 2009. And then Minnesota's No Child Left Behind waiver in 2012 largely built on this. So this was the first time that the state accountability system had this real emphasis on the growth for the school accountability system. And this uses a measure of growth that's called a Z-score system. In our Every Student Succeed Act plan, we had a lot of conversations with district advisory committees, with assessment directors, with psychometricians and educational organizations, and we decided to use a measure of growth in our ESSA plan that's called a transition model. So the basic difference between a Z-score model in our state statute and a transition model in our ESSA plan is that a Z-score model measures any level of growth. In a transition model, you receive, you're measured as growing when you move between different proficiency metrics. So you have to move from under proficiency to meet expectations or from meets to exceeds. And this really puts a lot more emphasis on growth towards proficiency. It's a more aggressive model, and that's what's included in our S-Estate plan. So we are recommending repealing this definition of low, medium, and high growth, both because it will be confusing for families to have two different measures of growth reported on our report card, and because this was identified in the 2017 OLA report on standardized student testing as a recommendation to remove this specific measure of growth.
Are there questions for Ms. Snyder on that explanation? Representative Mariani, did you have a question?
I'm sorry, good amendment.
Would you like to cite any other changes in this amendment?
Madam Chair, there are a number of areas that are amending the underlying bill related to this topic, but if it pleases the Chair, I will just note those as I walk through the bill.
That would be perfect. Thank you very much. Are there questions from members? Seeing none, hearing nothing, the Chair renews her motion that the 818-0586 amendment be adopted. All those in favor say aye.
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 Those opposed, no. The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. And now our presenters have the bill in the condition that they would like to present. So they have quite a walkthrough to do now. Welcome again to House File 3315 as amended, and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My intent today is to work from the MDE summary of the policy bill, but I will also be citing relevant line members for people that prefer to look through the bill itself.
So members, pull out your bill summaries if you don't have them in front of you. As Ms. Snyder said, she's going to use that as her guide. And I think that was really a good idea, because if we had nonpartisan doing this, that's what they would do. Thank you. Please proceed.
Madam Chair, starting in Section 1, the relevant language is at line 1.24. This deletes a cross-reference to a report, the Special Education Litigation Cost Report, which we're recommending for repeal in Article 2, Section 12. There are a number of reports that we are recommending for repeal in this bill, and so you'll see similar sections like this throughout. Section 2 is also very similar. It would delete a report under 123A26, starting at line 2.3. This is a statute which allows school districts to have their aid paid to cooperative units and then a report on that transferred aid. In the 20-some years that Dr. Tom Melcher and others have been at school finance, it's never been used, and so we are recommending it for repeal later on in Article 2, Section 12.
Thank you, Ms. Snyder. Are there any questions for Ms. Snyder on Article 1? Are there any in the audience who would like to testify to those changes? Thank you. Then we'll proceed to Article 2. And members, I will ask for testimony and questions after each article, because this is a lot. Please proceed, Ms. Snyder.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Starting in Section 1, we have a number of clarifying and technical changes to data disaggregation under 120B.35 Subdivision 2, and I preface these changes in our conversation about the legislative report on data disaggregation. So the first change is on line 2.20. This corrects a reference to Asian and Pacific Islander to align with the federal race definitions, where those would be two separate races. At line 2.23, we're adding language that would allow the state demographer to assist MDE in identifying which ethnicities in Minnesota are the most populous. There's a fair amount of statistical analysis that's involved here, and we want to make sure that we're using the best available information. And then the next language isn't until line 5.6. This removes a reference to the 4- and 6-year graduation rates to allow Minnesota Department of Education to disaggregate all graduation rates. Our ESSA plan has a recommendation to report graduation rates up to the 7-year, so we want to align with our state ESSA plan. And I should note, this will be amended by lines 1.13 to 1.15 of the A180586 amendment. There's a reference to medium and high growth in this section that would be removed and replaced with the word progress.
Yeah, thank you for that insertion.
Section 2 relates to the transfer of the Educator Licensing Division from the Minnesota Department of Education to PELSB. contained in last year's education omnibus bill. So this reassigns a requirement that MDE maintain a list of licensed and non-licensed staff members for school districts to PELSB. This data is collected through the STAR reporting system, which was transferred last year. And I should also note this Section 2 mirrors with Section 6, which reassigns this, which removes this requirement from MDE. Section 3 deletes a report required under 123B.14 subdivision 7 clerk records. I believe the House research summary refers to this as an archaic report. Section 4 clarifies a requirement. Oh, excuse me, Madam Chair. Section 4, starting at line 6.22, clarifies a requirement under 124D.78 subdivision 2. This relates to American Indian Education Parent Advisory Committees. The statute is a little ambiguous about how these concurrences of resolutions of concurrences or non-concurrences relating to their approval or disapproval of American Indian education, how these should be transmitted to the school board. Anecdotally, we've heard of some instances where they might be handed to the superintendent, who may suggest changes before they're transmitted to the school board. So this section would allow the parent advisory committee to give these resolutions directly to the school board. And then Section 5, this replicates the formula for medium and high growth in the calculation for literacy incentive aid. So literacy incentive aid, I believe that was passed in 2011 or 2012, and that used the definition of medium and high growth that we deleted in the previous amendment. So to make sure that there was no reallocation among districts in their literacy incentive aid, we've replicated this language. I should note this language was also modified by the amendment. Let me make sure I'm getting this correct. So the language at line 6.32, as modified by the amendment, now reads, scoring at least one half standard deviation or more below the state expected scores. Since posting that amendment online, we have had conversations about whether at least one half standard deviation or more below, whether or more is modifying below or modifying at least. I thought you might appreciate that as an English teacher. We think that we could have this further clarified later on. Okay. So that might be something to think about as this moves forward. Section 6, this mirrors with Section 2, as I mentioned. It removes the requirement that MDE maintain the list of licensed and non-licensed staff members for school districts. Section 7 moves a requirement that school districts report on how their basic skills revenue raise student achievement levels to their world's best workforce plan. So this would include basic skills revenue, so compensatory revenue, English language learner revenue. So it's a requirement that they report on how this revenue has raised student achievement levels, and we think it's more appropriate to be contained within the world's best workforce plan. Section 8 removes a report required under 128D06 subdivision 1, the board's annual report. I should note that chapter 128D is specific to Special School District Number 1, Minneapolis.
Yes.
Section 9, starting at line 8.27, this section relates to the transfer of the educator licensing division again. It removes a requirement that notices of expungements be sent to the Minnesota Department of Education. PELSB is already included in the list of agencies that receive these expungements, and these are sent out because it affects teacher licensure decisions. The relevant language, Section 10, starts at 13.25. And this is a little bit more substantive than just a clarifying change. So this section, this is the Maltreatment Act, Maltreatment of Minors Act. So this would add a cross-reference to the definition of sexual abuse to Site 609.352, which is the statute on solicitation of children to engage in sexual conduct. So this would give MDE the ability to investigate cases that fall under that statute, solicitation of children to engage in sexual conduct in our maltreatment investigations. So there have been cases where we've been able to investigate cases that might fall under that statute as threatened sexual abuse, but we would never want to be in a position where we weren't able to investigate cases like this that were reported to us. So we would like to add this cross-reference. And I should note that this is already an existing authority for counties in the Department of Human Services. Section 11, starting at 16.1, no, excuse me, starting at 15.28. This section clarifies the Grow Your Own Grants program to ensure both charter schools and school districts can apply for grants. And then section 12, starting at line 16.26, this is the repealer. The first repealer, 120D.35, subdivision 4, is a best practices in high-performing schools report. We're recommending it for repeal because each year the same best practices are identified by school districts. The second repealer is 120B.35 subdivision 5. That is a report called the Improving Graduation Rates for Students with Emotional and Behavioral Disorders. So this is a report that requires school districts with either a dropout rate above 25% for students with emotional and behavioral disorders or who have the lowest 25% graduation rate for these students to report report on their further actions with these students. So this legislation was enacted in 2004, whereas in 2005, the Federal Office of Special Education Programs passed a requirement for students to report graduation rates for all students with disabilities as part of the Minnesota State Performance Plan Annual Performance Report. So it's duplicative of a federal reporting requirement. We're not saying that this information is not valuable to be reported. The third repealer is 123A.26 subdivision 3, cooperative units, prohibited aids, and levies. That's the item I spoke about in section 1 of article 1 relating to districts having the ability to transfer funding to co-ops that has not been used. The fourth item is the repeal of 125A.75 subdivision 9, the special education litigation cost report. And the fifth repealer is subdivision 3 of 128D.06, the Minneapolis Public School Board's annual report. And I should note that the amendment, the second amendment that we adopted this evening, also includes a number of repealers added to the section related to the medium and high growth formula.
And Ms. Snyder, we have another report on litigation costs, therefore the repeal of this particular subdivision 9, correct?
Madam Chair, this information is reported through UFARS. I don't believe that there's another report on special education litigation costs.
Is that correct, Mr. Rooney?
Yes, Madam Chair, we have a report specifically on special education litigation costs with that title. And yes, our reasoning is that the information is available through UFARS.
Okay, thank you. Is there any testimony on Article 2? Are there any questions from members? Thank you very much. Let's proceed to Article 3.
Okay.
Teachers. Oh, did someone? I keep hearing these noises, so I'm not sure if someone is just hitting the microphone or wanting to speak. Thank you. Let's go to Article 4.
So Article 4, Section 1.
Excuse me. We have Article 3, teachers.
I jumped ahead. Article 3,
page 60,
Section 1. So the relevant language that we're looking at here is at 1711. So this section would remove Option 5 under Statute 122A.183, which currently allows a Tier 2 teacher who has taught for 3 years and has evidence of a summative teacher evaluation that did not result in placing a teacher on an improvement plan into the Tier 3 licensure. This was a topic of conversation last year during interim, and the governor remains committed to ensuring that teachers have relevant teaching, teacher training, and content in pedagogy.
Is there any testimony to Article 3? You both may have to move for a while.
welcome to the testifying table. If there's anyone else coming down, just come in and get seated or sit behind. Ms. Kelleher, join at the table. Mr. Bartholomew, be on deck. Welcome to the committee. Please say your name and begin.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members. I'm Sarah Ford, and I'm a policy researcher at Education Minnesota. We're here in support of House File 3315, specifically this provision in Article 3, Section 1, which eliminates the ability to obtain a renewable teaching license without the content and pedagogy training that we know is critical to student success. Every other pathway to a Tier 3 license in 122A183 sub D2 requires demonstration that the teacher has met the standards of effective practice for his or her licensure field, either through completion of a Minnesota-approved teacher preparation program from another state, a content-specific portfolio, or as another way of saying another license from another state. But the fifth provision is a gigantic and problematic loophole that will have profound impacts on our students and our student achievement. That's the one that reads that just 3 years of teaching experience under Tier 2 licensure and evidence of a summative evaluation that did not put the person on an improvement plan gets it a Tier 3 with some testing too. It's not comparable to any of the other pathways because it does not require completion of or even enrollment in the teacher preparation program. There is no requirement, therefore, that these teachers will ever have taken a single childhood development class, a literacy course, a course on teaching diverse learners, a course on special education. There's no requirement even that these teachers have ever taken a single course in their content field. The creation of a track to allow teachers to move from Tier 1 to 3 with nothing more than test scores and a single methods requirement defies more than 50 years of academic research that shows rigorous teacher preparation in both content and pedagogy leads to higher levels of student academic achievement and higher levels of teacher retention. Importantly, education researchers have also built a strong body of evidence to show that a lack of teacher preparation leads to negative outcomes for students. Evidence also highlights that it's the students in our most high-need schools who are the students who are most likely to be harmed by the lowering teacher standards. Students in our most linguistically, racially, culturally, and economically diverse schools and our special education students are more likely than other students to be taught by teachers with some level of certification that is less than their state's highest standard and who are teaching without any preparation in the assigned field at all. Our kids who most need our best-trained teachers have been and remain the least likely to get those teachers. Decades of research tell us two things. Robust teacher preparation in both content and pedagogy leads to higher student achievement, and underprepared and unprepared teachers lead to lower levels of student achievement. As written, Tier 3 will allow a teacher to receive an indefinitely renewable license without any assurance that the teacher has the training that we know is necessary to be successful in the classroom. We hope that even some of the authors of last year's bill would be supportive of removing this loophole since it was not a part of the House bill last year until after conference committee, and we thank you very much.
Are there questions for Ms. Ford? Representative
Kudish Badid. Thank you, Chair. It's getting late. Yes. If I am a teacher myself, and I went, through the coursework and as a master's degree. So if I understand this correctly, does this mean that at that level, a person who's not licensed could go from one school to the next for 3 years? Not having taken any coursework, not having, taken any pedagogy or child behavior or any of those kind of courseworks, and then after 3 years, they would have a license to teach without, they could continue to teach until they wanted, as long as they wanted to?
So Tier 3, Madam Chair, I apologize. Madam Chair. So Tier 3 is the first level of tiers that is mobile. That is Tiers 1 and Tiers 2, the district and the applicants have to apply jointly, and that license is limited to the district that made the application or the charter school that made the application. Tier 3 is a fully mobile license, and it is renewable indefinitely. So 3-year license instead of a 5-year license, but folks can get there and stay there throughout their careers. So, yes, you can get all the way to a fully mobile professional license without ever having participated in the teacher preparation.
Thank you.
Ms. Kelleher, welcome. Say your name for the record and begin.
Good evening, Madam Chairman and members. My name is Grace Kelleher, and I represent the Minnesota School Boards Association. And I want from the start to state that my organization has been in favor and advocated actively in favor of these tiers going forward. And we would like to encourage the committee to leave the language in. Let us collect some data. Let us see as we go forward. The idea that you'd immediately take something off the table without a history and without any case studies going forward just seems to go against some of the flexibility we wanted to incorporate here in Minnesota.
Are there questions for Ms. Kelleher? Representative Koenig-Bedien.
Thank you, Ms. Kelleher. So you are in favor of allowing a teacher into our classrooms that has not gone through any training for up to 3 years with no timetable on it. When we talk about our students being our most precious asset in Minnesota, when we talk about providing the highest quality education for our students, how can we allow that to happen? I'm kind of dumbfounded, to tell you the truth. And as a teacher myself, when I think of all the hard work I went through, I was a single parent. I went on the weekends. I went to school. I supported myself. It took me 17 years to pay off my student loans. And somebody who just thinks they might want to teach, and maybe they're really good at it, but haven't had the training in math or science or health, haven't had instruction in how to address emotional issues, how to create relationships, could just walk, you know, just come in and basically you're saying, well, let's just give it a try. That doesn't sound like Minnesota. That doesn't sound like let's just see it and see how it goes. We don't do that for the medical practices. We don't say that to a fireman or a nurse. How can we do that with our with our students? You know, as a teacher, we are held to the highest levels and expectations. When something goes wrong, it's on us. And we are always expected to do our continuing education, our professional development. You know, we spend a lot of money continuing to train ourselves. And this person could come in and basically do none of that and be allowed to become a teacher with none of the responsibility that the rest of us have gone to. I mean, imagine, why would we, any of us, go to school anymore? Why would we continue professional development anymore? I'm just really confused and dumbfounded by this whole thing, and I would absolutely strike it out. There's no way I would ever support something like that. Thank you.
Ms. Kelleher, would you like to respond to that?
Madam Chairman, if I could, my friend next to me has the site in front of him.
Mr. Bartholomew, please introduce yourself for the record and begin. Welcome.
Madam Chair, members, excuse me, my name is Jim Bartholomew with the Minnesota Business Partnership, and we also would encourage the committee to maintain the tier structure that was adopted last year for a variety of reasons. More quickly to your question, Representative, I think it's also important to read what you have to do to be a Tier 2 teacher. You can't just be someone after 3 years and decide to apply to get a Tier 3 license. To be a Tier 2 license, A, you have to have a district willing to hire you, and then there's quite a list of criteria that you have to meet to be hired as a, or to receive a Tier 2 license. You either have to have a bachelor's degree or meet a variety of criteria for career and technical ed, if that's the area you're focusing on. In addition, you have to complete two out of a series of five different criteria, which includes field-specific methods of training, including coursework, You do have to pass the score on the pedagogy and content exams, completion of a state-approved teacher prep program. Now, those are just a couple of the five. In addition, you'd also have to either be you could either be enrolled in a Minnesota-approved teacher prep program, have a master's degree in the specified content area, and all that time while you're in Tier 2, you have to go through a teacher evaluation program and be found to be making satisfactory progress. So I think it's unfair to characterize someone who's coming to this stage as just being someone off the streets and not having to have any preparation. And if they were granted a Tier 3 license, they're still going to have to do the continuing ed and things like that. So I think if the legislature and the governor struck a good balance last year with the tiered structure, moving from one level to the next, each building off of the previous. And so while you're just looking at Tier 3 here, I think it's important to look at the Tier 2 statutes as well. There's a lot of requirements there. I hope that's helpful.
Representative Makeway.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I might have a question for the previous testifier, but to Ms. Kelleher, so part of the reasoning for keeping language and not striking it out was to see if we could collect some data and see what happens. But what happens if we collect that data and it shows that it's not working well? Do those teachers that have become Tier 3 licensed teachers lose their licenses? Do they have, I guess I'm trying to understand. I mean, gambling with our students isn't always my favorite thing either. But what would happen to those teachers then if it didn't go well? That would be my first question. And my second, I think, is I'm wondering, so when we had a long conversation in committee about the tiered licensure, and it was a big conversation, where did this language come from? And if it did only come out of conference committee, who proposed it? And, I'm obviously just seeing it for the first time now as it's being struck out, but I want to know where that came from and why it wasn't part of the original plan for whomever that is.
Well, Representative Makeway, it was Senator Pratt's language, but it did survive the conference committee, and the governor signed the bill, so we proceed. Would you like to answer the question, one of you who would address her first question?
Madam Chair?
Ms. Kelleher.
Representative Makeway, I would suggest to you that you have to have a good substantive evaluation, three of them, going forward. And that idea that you would be continually being checked by your school district to make sure you're making and doing good things for kids, I think the whole process itself has started to have us look at every single person in our school districts. How are they performing? Are they making good things happen for our children? And I think this was part of the bar. It's going to change things for kids, hopefully, around the state.
Madam Chair. May I ask a question to the previous testifier?
Of course. But just a minute. Representative Erdahl, did you have a question on these two testifiers? Please proceed. And Representative Mariani as well.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'm certainly glad there are all those safeguards in there, but they lead me to thinking that because we have those safeguards, do you think we even need preparation courses in our colleges? Maybe that would save a lot of time and money for our students if they didn't even have to do them. And with those safeguards in mind, would you think that, both of you please answer, that we maybe even don't need preparation courses in our colleges?
Ms. Kelleher.
Madam Chairman, Representative Erdahl, I would share to you that I do believe teacher preparation courses are good to some extent. For what you can learn without being in front of kids, that works really well. But we're looking at a teacher shortage of epic proportion. Our higher ed institutions are not turning out teachers in the numbers we need to go forward. And I suppose if you decide that all these precursors somehow don't make you a good teacher, what's our choice? Do you leave school boards with the idea that they have to put 40 kids in a classroom if you only have one classroom teacher? Where are our choices going forward? And I think
you know, the system itself, it has worked for many years. The problem was you were starting to leave the kids in Minnesota behind because we can't produce enough teachers going forward. And it is important to have someone who wants to be there and wants to be sharing. And maybe they don't have a BS in teaching, but maybe they've got a BS in chemistry. And if they're teaching chemistry, that might be equally beneficial.
Representative Pryor, is your question of these two testifiers? Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Erdahl, I'll follow up.
Well, I would like to hear Mr. Bartholomew as well, then I have a quick follow-up.
Mr. Bartholomew.
Representative Erdahl, I don't think we're there yet to make that kind of a conclusion. And that's, I think it's why it's a number of the options in Tier 2 are a person would complete a teacher prep program. That again, is options. And I think through the continuing ed, it would be a logical thing for someone to complete a teacher ed program to the degree they found that contributed to their professional expertise. You know, in 10, 20 years, if we go through this structure and we have a chance to look back and future legislatures get a chance to, I think that's a question we should always look, not just in teaching, but, you know, we should always have a blank slate before us and look at the data and what's the best thing to do. But I think there are protections in this system, and certainly teacher prep is a preferred option in this system. So at this point, I would say no, we wouldn't want to drop that. But that's not to say we couldn't look at data 10, 20 years and see what's working best.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And, you know, certainly I'm concerned about the shortage. I just think that there are a lot of different approaches that we could take that would lead to more high-quality teachers than what is being suggested. I mean, just things like retention through better mentorship programs, training through year-long student teaching, which is something I've advocated. I would hope that in the future we could take much closer looks at those.
Representative Pryor.
I'll try the previous testifier.
Representative Mariani, is it for these two?
Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And I have to say this was the provision that gave me the most heartburn last year, and I did support Chair Erickson's bill, and I do think that the House did have the wiser approach on this issue. I certainly did want to open up for a new approach for a number of reasons, including what, you know, Ms. Kelleher just shared. I did wrestle with whether or not two out of the five that are listed, and I think the overall frame is a fair frame, but I don't know. I really don't know. I have not seen the literature yet that convinces me that that some of these protections are equivalent to what could be possible through a structured teacher prep program. And I suspect we're not going to know that for quite a while. And so maybe there should have been five other different ones here. And so I just thought that the Senate approached this a little bit too experimentally, and we can have an honest difference of opinion on that. I think that Ms. Kelleher, you suggested that we should not do a big change because we should then, and Representative McQuaid spoke to this, because we should, let's see if it works or not. But it does seem to me that that approach is not a realistic approach, you know, that if in fact we find that, there are some of these five elements here that really just don't work for us, and we allow this to go through, and so this really is the time to continue to have this debate. It seems to me then we're probably facing a mountain of litigation, on the part, I'd sue if I were one of the Tier 2 going to Tier 3, and then, you know, empirical data comes back and says, you know, this isn't working for Minnesota, you know, we're going to take away your license, I would sue. And so I just really want us, regardless of how we feel about this, to think about it, to be very, very deliberate and careful here, because we're not going to get another shot to avoid that possibility again. And so, you know, I do support this move. I did vote for the bill. I did vote for the final bill as well. I think the general direction here is the right direction. You know, there's some opening up. You know, there's a new, you know, tiered system that matches reality. But this is one area that causes me the most to pause. And it was not the area that this body deliberated through and sent forward. And we had some tough deliberations here. So anyway, Madam Chair, I guess I was going to turn that into a question in terms of the litigation thing, but I think I'm right, you know, that I think we are potentially, if the assumption is we can study this and, this, and then change it, you know, frankly, I think we're putting the state of Minnesota and school districts in a potentially litigious, you know, situation. So I think we should, if our intent is to study this, I think we ought to do what the department is suggesting here and then back up and see if there's some kind of, you know, pilot ways in which for us to move forward with this experimentation.
I believe we want to revert to Education Minnesota testifier Ms. Ford for a couple of questions. Representative Pryor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I'm thinking of the scenario. I am a college student, and I think in my career once I want to go into teaching. Mm-hmm. If I understand how the system works, I would say I'm not going to spend time taking any classes relating to teaching, because if I can go out and get a job and teachers are in demand, I can just get a job. And I certainly am not going to spend time doing student teaching where I'm not getting paid. And so, again, I'm extending my student debt. You know, I would just try to get into teaching as quickly as possible. And then I'm going to find out this is really hard because I wasn't prepared. And so I'm thinking that you referenced research about how people stay in teaching when they've been properly prepared. And if you've not been prepared well, you leave teaching. And here I want to talk about and address this idea of teacher shortages and whether or not down the road we're creating a bigger teacher shortage than we think we're solving in a short time. So do you have research that could speak to that question?
Yes, on a couple of... Oh, I'm sorry, Madam Chair. I apologize. On a couple of points, we do know through national research that teacher attrition rates are higher when teachers are teaching outside of the field for which they were prepared, or when they're teaching in an area and they weren't, or if they're teaching outside of preparation at all. So when teachers aren't prepared for their assignment, they are more likely to leave, and they're more likely to leave more quickly. And there's the second part of your question. Could you remind me?
Well, Representative Pryor.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. So the part of the question where you say when they're not prepared. And is there research that speaks to that?
Ms. Ford.
In terms of teacher attrition rates, they're far less likely to stay in the profession for a long period of time when they're not fully prepared in that licensure field. Yes.
Ms. Ford, would you provide us with that research, please?
Yes, we'd be happy to. We have a new report available, and we'd be happy to provide it.
Thank you. Representative May Quaid.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just to be really clear, because I remember when we went through the tiered licensure before, I remember thinking to myself, oh, I could be a teacher now, because in Tier 1 it's bachelor's degree, and in Tier 2 it's you don't have to be enrolled in a teacher preparation program. You can be, but you could also just have 2 years of teaching in that field, which would have been completed in the Tier 1. So my question for you was about the research about other states that have teachers who don't have to go through this content preparation and teacher preparation, what their outcomes are like. And then I'm not a teacher. Like, I have a bachelor's degree in world religion and politics, basically are the three degrees I have. And so I have no idea what teacher prep looks like. What is that? What would I have been missing if I tried to go into teaching and didn't take any of those courses? What would I not have?
Ms. Orr. Madam Chair, so there's a robust body of academic research that's been happening in every decade where we've had the need to hire some kind of emergency hire provisions, where we've had a teacher shortage throughout the United States. There's been an opportunity for academics to then study the difference between the folks who came under some kind of emergency hire and the folks who came into full certification, whatever the state's full certification might be. And so in all but two of the last six decades, we've had the ability to study both cohorts and look at what the difference in student outcomes is. And so when we say, as a researcher, when I hear let's put this in place and see what happens, I want to say, well, we've been looking at what happens for the last 60 years, and we know what happens to students who are in schools with high numbers of underprepared or unprepared teachers, and they have lower academic outcomes, and they have higher teacher attrition rates. So that's one piece. The other piece that's related to the questions that were just asked have to do with our teacher shortage, and just want to remind folks that in Minnesota, our teacher attrition rates are through the roof. They're incomparable to any other field. One out of every three teachers leaves the profession in Minnesota in the first 5 years with an average debt of $31,500 and a degree that's good for nothing else. So if we're not going to do something about teacher attrition, the teacher shortage is going to remain a powerful, powerful problem.
And I just wanted to know a little bit about what I was missing.
That's okay. Yes, so Madam Chair, the literature looks quite heavily at how much in content is ideal and how much in pedagogy is ideal. And there seems to be a leveling off in content. The research shows it's important to have content background. The research about whether or not a major in field is mixed. So the researchers have identified there seems to be a threshold effect. If I'm going to be a math teacher, I need to have a certain number of math courses, but having umpteen more doesn't necessarily make me a better math teacher. So going all the way on to have my PhD in math doesn't necessarily move me to a more effective teacher. What comes into play then is the interplay with math pedagogy and how math learning happens, and understanding those two things are clearly interrelated in terms of student outcomes. So the pedagogy and the content are interrelated. Content by itself isn't necessarily an indicator of an effective teacher. Pedagogy comes in as having a higher effect on effectiveness, but both are in play.
Representative Board.
Thank you, Madam Chair. There are also some other classes that would be required in terms of teacher preparation. I think that's what Representative McQuaid was asking. So maybe you could answer that, but I also have just a clarification. When you say teachers who are not prepared leave more quickly, so if we're bringing a teacher in for a couple of years, they're not becoming proficient. They don't have a time, have the opportunity. We're not mentoring them. And, I mean, I'm making a presumption. Is that something that your data shows, that not only are they less satisfied and the students aren't doing as well, but we're setting up a rotating schedule of teachers who are not prepared, aren't staying long to develop their proficiency, and what are we doing with kids then?
Right, Madam Chair, and we see a great deal of damage to student outcomes in schools that have really a revolving door of teachers, and the schools are hemorrhaging money because they're constantly recruiting, and there's some new tools out there that offer a cost analysis of what it costs a district or a school to replace a teacher. And so when schools and districts are constantly dealing with teacher churn, they have teachers who come in for 2 years, they're constantly recruiting, they can't start and embed new initiatives, they can't develop the collaborative relationships that we know that are necessary for ongoing work with students and various programs in schools. So yes, we see damage there with the high attrition rates and the revolving doors of teachers that hurt schools and hurts kids.
Well, members, let's keep in mind, thank you, Ms. Ford, let's keep in mind that, you know, there are hiring policies within our districts,
And I have great faith that our school districts who hire, hire the best they can get. And there's a summative teacher evaluation that we have enacted through this legislature that must mean something. So I just keep that in mind, because summative evaluations are supposed to be held up to be very valuable. So I think we can move on. I know how you feel, and I think you know how I feel. So don't expect to see this in the final bill. Article 4, Facilities and Technology. Our presenters shall return.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, again, my name is Caitlin Snyder with the Minnesota Department of Education. So Article 4, with the relevant language starting at line 17.24, would make a couple of changes to the lead and water provisions that were passed last year. First, it would require that all buildings that serve students be tested for the presence of lead within 2 years, so by 2020. It would also require either remediation or to have faucet shutoffs when testing finds the presence of lead. So I should be sure to point out that there's definitely better alignment that could happen between the language that's here and the guidelines that have been presented from the Minnesota Department of Health. For example, our language says the presence of lead, whereas the MDH guidelines have sort of a increased scale depending on how high of the lead presence is. They also pointed out to us that we use the phrase water for consumption, which is more broad than the phrase they're going with, which is potable. So there could definitely be better alignment between the language here in this bill and the guidelines that are moving forward from the Department of Health.
So Ms. Snyder, are you anticipating amending this at all? Mr. Ernie.
Madam Chair. Members of the committee, thanks for the question. I think we've heard from the stakeholders. We've met with MDH. I think we're open to having conversations around coming to an agreement around this. I think everyone agrees that we want to make sure that our water is safe for our kids. I think the governor and the commissioner feel that what we asked last year could be enhanced some more, and so we're open to having conversations.
Thank you. I appreciate that, because having bottled water could be very costly for our school districts. So I hope that we can negotiate something that's reasonable. Is there anyone in the audience who would like to testify? He's bringing a bottle of water. Welcome, Mr. Donham, and please state your name for the record and begin. This is Josh Donham.
Madam Chair, members, Josh Down with the Minneapolis Public Schools. I'm actually testifying on behalf of MASA, MSBA, AMSD, and St. Paul Schools. I was volunteered, Madam Chair. So I just wanted to stress, as Mr. Uni said, we all take this issue very seriously. Exposures to high level of lead is an important problem that we all need to, as schools across the state, are wrestling with. But I wanted to point out a few concerns we have with the proposed language. As you recall, Madam Chair, we worked with Representative Thiessen, Representative Fenton last session in this committee to arrive at a process to get all schools tested within 5 years. In part, that was due to simply the capacity for testing that many schools across the state in a short amount of time. I can tell you in the Minneapolis Public Schools, we've already begun that process, even though the law doesn't start that until July 1. Mm-hmm. And we started with those buildings that are the oldest and those that have youngest children in it. So we are doing those buildings and looking and trying to find the presence of lead at all of those potable water locations. But the going from the current standard, which is the current EPA standard and the current standard set in state rule, to a zero tolerance standard, which is what is in this, or even the guideline standard Ms. Snyder referenced of 2, would unnecessarily alarm families and really force us to put resources into plumbing instead of other areas of school facilities and safety. And would essentially set schools apart from not only the EPA standard and state rule, but also the plumbing codes and that which guide the construction of homes and offices. So it really would set us apart, and it would actually be very challenging given the current plumbing codes that allow small amounts of lead in piping and solder to actually hit a zero target. And the reason, actually, Madam Chair, that I brought this bottle of water, I think you'll appreciate this with your Aquafina in front of you. The standard set by the federal government for this is 5 parts per billion.
That's correct.
So this language would say if we have the presence of 1 part per billion in that drinking fountain, we would have to replace it with one that has 5 parts per billion. I know Mr. Rooney and I have had several conversations, and we certainly will work with the Department of Health and Department of Education, but really do want to say that this goes well beyond where it should be for what's safe for students. Thanks, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Are there questions, Representative Arianne?
Thank you, Madam Chair, for authoring a bill where I get to beat up on my friends in the committee. This is Roger, now it's Josh. I won't ask the snarky question, which is, really, what is a safe level of lead? Because I think we all know the answer to that. There is no safe level of lead. We know what the federal government, EPA, says, but we also know what the science says on this. So we're talking about, in schools, obviously we're talking about minds that are still in their most highly developed stage, right? It seems to me that, and it's interesting because I'm not sure I've seen language like this in 17.26 that says such as using bottled water, so it doesn't mandate using bottled water, and so maybe I should be beating up my other friend, Adolsh, on what the heck such as means, here. But I think that the intent of this is to be able to aggressively and assertively move our schools to the safest possible place. So perhaps there's a better way to write all this. I do know by sitting with the department that there's all sorts of helpful, I don't know if it's a rule or not, but they have an approach here that isn't meant to be dictating to schools in a non-flexible way, that there's a lot of flexibility that's built into the communication that the department has been issuing and intends to issue, forward to our school districts. And perhaps that might also be language that needs to work its way in here or clear a reference, and perhaps Mr. Rooney can speak to that issue. But I sure would hate for us, Madam Chair, to finish this legislative session without some kind of an assertive, it's got to work, it's got to be workable, I get it, but some kind of an assertive expectation on our part relative to this issue.
Representative Mariani, did you read Representative Thiessen's letter?
I did not.
Yeah. Oh, I'll have to give you a copy. Mr. Donham.
Madam Chair, Representative Mariani, appreciate your comments. I think the main question that's at the heart of your statement was that what is, if a student ingests water at a school building, and we know that doctors look at an elevated blood level of roughly 10, I believe, is what they look at when they report to the city health department for looking into issues at home around the presence of lead and dust and so on in homes. So my main question, I don't actually have the answer to this, but I think is kind of at the heart of yours. What would a student have to drink, a kindergartner, with, let's say, 2 parts per billion to get to an elevated blood level of 10, or whatever science deems as a concern? And I don't know the answer, but I think if we had that answer, I think it would help guide what we do this session. My assumption is it would be very hard, frankly, to ingest that much water to get to a level that is of concern. But I think the folks who know the science better than I can answer that. I think, Madam Chair, that'd be a topic for the future.
Thank you. Mr. Uni, did you have a response to this?
Yes, Madam Chair, members, Adoch Uni again from the Department of Education. Again, I will just say, as to our language, we are obviously open to having discussions. I would reference the guidance from MDH and MDE, and I would say that, you know, I think there has been a little bit of confusion around the progress around the guidance. The referenced band of lead in parts per billion from the, I think the range was 2 to 20, that would possibly cause alarm for parents. The guidance, I think, as was acknowledged, is optional, completely through the range, especially in that area. But the options that parents would be made aware of in that area, I'm just reading broadly from the guidance that has been updated, I believe recently as well. It's just retesting sample taps, considering the feasibility of flushing, and making all test results and materials accessible to the community. So there's no even suggestion about taking out pipes or fixing the water source. It's just retesting feasibility of flushing and making all test results. And if there's any detailed questions about the guidance and the process that maybe provide clarification for members, we do have representatives from the Department of Health who would be able to answer some of those questions.
Mr. Dunham, you were telling me about the flushing that goes on in Minneapolis. Would you just speak to that a bit?
Certainly. So, Madam Chair, we have detected lead in some of our buildings, and our custodial staff every morning get to the building prior to students, and we have to open up every single tap for a number of minutes and flush all of those potable water locations. That's at a standard of 20 parts per billion, and I believe we flush about half of our buildings. If we were to go to a standard of 2, we would be flushing every building, including our brand-new district headquarters, the Davis Center, which we have one faucet that tested, again, over a weekend, tested about 8. Now, we can flush that, and we do, but that particular one, but when it comes down to it, my concern gets back to the language that was passed last session, and what's actually not contained in Article 4 here in the policy bill is actually Subdivision 1, which this legislature was guidance to the department. To the extent possible, the commissioner shall base the plan on the standards established by the United States Environmental Protection Agency. The plan may be based on the technical guidance in the department's health document reducing lead in drinking water. The EPA standard still exists, and, you know, with Resident Mariani and I, that communication, we'd love to engage in what is that safe level and dig deeper into it. Mm-hmm. But getting down to 2 would require us to flush every building, and that's not just in Minneapolis. That's buildings across the state. I think we need to know what the safe level is. Is it 0? Then we have to change our plumbing codes as a state. Is it 2? Is it 5? Is it 20? To me, that's the discussion that we should have first before we go from 20 down to 2.
Representative Mariani.
Madam Chair, I'm confused, and I think I'm hearing two different things. So Mr. Orney just said that in the guidance between 2 and 20, there's a framework here where we use optional. If I'm wrong, I'm hearing wrong, you know, but you're comparing your 5 parts, you know, to the between 2 and 20, which is optional. What am I confused about? Perhaps Mr. Uni can help me with this.
Mr. Uni?
Madam Chair, Representative Mariani, and I just want to make clear that that's around what the guidance says. There is discussion we have to have about the language in our proposal. That aside, if we keep it specifically to the language, the way you phrase it, Representative Mariani, I would say that that's accurate, that it's optional in that 2 to 20. And it is optional after 20. It's just stronger language. It's stronger encouragement.
Mr. Dunham?
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Mariani. I think when you put a standard or a guidance out of 2, parents will rightly then ask, my school is at 3. What are you doing to my child?
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think we have the science has coalesced around 2 or 1 or 0 or 20. I mean, the EPA standard is 15 at point source and 20 at the tap. If we want to go and put out their guidance of 0, even if it's voluntary, I believe families will be alarmed.
Do we want to hear from the Department of Health since they have come to enjoy our debate here? Please come
Madam
forward,
Chair,
gentlemen.
I think that would be very helpful.
Yes. Welcome to our committee, gentlemen. I'm so glad that you would take the time out to come and please identify yourself and address this issue.
Madam Chair and members, my name is Paul Elwood. I'm Assistant Commissioner of the Department of Health. And I have with me Mr. Randy Ellingbo, who's the State Drinking Water Program Manager at the Department of Health. So, I understand that we understand the consternation that is revolving around the issue of what's in our guidance. But I'd like to, kind of state somewhat emphatically that we have, in fact, developed a set of guidance and a model testing plan that we expect districts could use or they could choose not to use because the law does allow them the option to develop their own testing plan. We've not created any new requirements or any new rules in developing this guidance. And I also want to state, too, that, we led, as everybody, as has been said before, is a very serious hazard, and particularly so for younger people. And our knowledge has taken us to a place where we now believe that there's no safe level of lead. That's not what our guidance is trying to address, because we understand also that lead is fairly ubiquitous, and so we've not proposed any options that would require zero tolerance for lead, as was stated. What we're trying to do is provide practical options for school districts, including the ones that want to be more aggressive or more assertive in trying to mitigate their lead hazards based upon their testing results. I'd like to perhaps have Mr. Ellingbo speak a little bit more about what some of our discussions have been in to get us to the place that we and what stakeholders we work to get us to the place we are with respect to the guidance.
Welcome, Mr. Ellingbo. Would you say your name for the record and then begin?
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Randy Ellingbo, and I'm manager of the Drinking Water Protection Section at the Department of Health. And over the course of the last several months particularly, we have been working to pull together this guidance that was required under the statute last year. And as we have done so, looked for reference to, those documents referenced in the statute, EPA's 3T's guidance, as well as our own guidance that has been in place for some time as a guide. And among the challenges we've had is, those guides were put together quite some time ago, in some cases over 20 years, and our understanding of lead has changed during that time. That said, what's still in place are the numbers that were referred to earlier.
Mm-hmm.
20 parts per billion in the EPA 3T's guide for schools, and then, within our own rules, 15 parts per billion for community public water supplies to work from. I think the really pertinent number for this discussion tonight is the 20 parts per billion. And I know we've also talked about 2 parts per billion, and I'm going to look to the language in the bill as what I think is the reference there, and it may be that I need clarification on that, but where it says that a school district that finds presence of lead in any water source that can provide water for consumption must remediate that water source or shut off the water source and must provide an alternate source of water, such as using bottled water, if another acceptable water source is not within reasonable distance. So I'm going, the 2 parts per billion that we've been talking about also in the discussion tonight, I believe relates specifically to the language in this bill. For many laboratories, 2 parts per billion is what they we would call the detection limit. That's as far down as they can go in terms of looking for the presence of lead. And so I will say if that's the appropriate reference here, that if you're finding lead at the detection level, you have to take that action, then that would I can see how that would cause a level of concern. And to go back to some of the discussion that Mr. Oney had provided about the development of the guide, part of what we've been working with the stakeholders group that is made up of school representatives is to try and understand some of the practical aspects of management of this problem in the schools and the difficulties that can come with trying to meet 2 parts per billion. And so to draw this together, the guide that we have worked on in order to have a guide available for the schools and a template for a plan as required under the statute references 20 parts per billion as certainly that level at which action is recommended. And then that guide also has options for schools to consider to take if they find the presence of lead below 20 but above 2, so that they do have options, again, if they choose to be more proactive about taking action at those levels below 20. And so our goal has been to understand not only the perspective of the schools, but then develop a guide that we hope is responsive to the need for reducing lead exposure to children. So I'm sorry, it's kind of a long summary, but I thought it important to draw some of these things together. So
thank you, Mr. Ellingville. Representative Pryor, did you have a question of these gentlemen?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Part of my question has already been answered, and then I thought of a new question. And you wouldn't be the right people. But one thing I'm interested, but the Department of Health, is there different standards now for new construction? I know that, you know, and that's now that's actually a statewide issue. So that as a school, there are choices that you can make in plumbing that reduce lead. Is that a standard now? And I don't think this is necessarily related to this bill, but thank you.
Mr. Ellingville.
Madam Chair, Representative, thank you. That's a great question, and the answer is yes. I'm trying to remember if it was 2014, EPA passed a requirement that plumbing fixtures used for drinking water consumption have no more than 0.25% lead in brass. Previously, you could have up to 8% mm-hmm. lead in those faucets or fixtures. And so that was a significant change. And so new construction, it is required that those low-lead or no-lead fixtures be installed. You can't use the old high-lead ones. So, and that will help us progress in reducing exposure to lead in drinking water.
Thank you, Mr. Ellingville. Thank you for the question, Representative Pryor. That's good for us to know. Are there any others who want to testify or ask questions of these testifiers in regard to Article 4, Section 1, Subdivision 3B, clause? Thank you, gentlemen, very much. Let's go on to Article 5, Nutrition. Welcome back to the table, Mr. Oney and Ms. Snyder.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Article 5, Nutrition, has 3 sections. The first section starting at line 18.3, that's where the relevant language is. Last year, we passed legislation that allows food service contracts to be renewed up to 4 years. Mm-hmm. This adds a cross-reference to federal law for the summer programs and child and adult care food programs so they can have the same extension. Section 2 explicitly clarifies, starting at line 19.4, the relevant language, explicitly clarifies that a school district can collect unpaid meal debt consistent with the provisions in Section 3. Section 3, starting at line 19.22, outlines a non-exhaustive list of activities that are prohibited when collecting student debt. This would include dumping meals, announcing students' names publicly, affixing stickers, and limiting participation in extracurricular activities. Our intent with this language was that you wouldn't penalize, say, somebody who wasn't able to pay for a field trip. You wouldn't penalize their ability to participate in an athletics program. There might be concern about whether this would allow somebody to partake in athletics without paying the athletics fee, so we're aware of that, and we'll continue to address that concern.
Thank you. I'm glad you're going to address that. Mm-hmm. Are there any questions for members? Let's move on to, was there anyone in the audience who wanted to address Section 3, Subdivision 4, no fees, or any other part of nutrition? Please say your name for the record and begin.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Jessica Webster. I'm a staff attorney with Legal Aid, and I have a handout, if I could.
Paige?
Pass this.
Yes. Matthias, she has a handout.
Madam Chair, members, Legal Aid has been working on this this issue of lunch shaming for several years. I think we thought it was resolved. We worked with Representative Sarah Anderson, who had some, the language at 19.20, which says the participant must also ensure that any reminders for payment of outstanding student meal balances do not demean or stigmatize.
Yes.
I think we thought that that would cover this issue, and unfortunately we're still having some issues around lunch shaming. I handed out two handouts because I'm a little concerned. I don't know that this language that the department has drafted actually achieves anything new. I believe Representative Anderson's language is fairly clear on it, but I think what Representative Anderson's language lacked was some kind of enforcement mechanism. And this language that the department has put forward provides more definition of what a stigmatizing or demeaning practice is, which is fine. But it's not clear to me that if a district uses one of these practices, that there is any recourse for the department, for a parent, for a concerned teacher to do anything about it. So just two examples that I'm not sure this language would prevent in the future. The first was what happened in Stuartville this fall. Mm-hmm. You'll see the highlighted language. You know, this was 140-some lunches that were retained from kids. There were reports in the media that a cashier dumped lunches into a bucket. I don't know if that happened or not, but it's clear that the staff that were in that lunchroom retained lunches from people and threw them out later. So it's not clear to me that that constitutes a dumping practice. The second page of the handout is a response that we received from Battle Lake. Legal Aid has done a data practices request this year of all school districts to see what their practices are, and we have a lot of different practices and policies across the state, but I just pulled this one as an example of, again, a district where if a child has a meal debt, an older child has a meal debt, and they attempt to purchase an a la carte item, they might be referred for detention or suspension. Presuming good intent from the district, I presume that they think this is kind of akin to stealing. I think as someone who represents low-income children, we have a child attempting to steal food in a lunchroom, it might illustrate a deeper problem that should be addressed in a different way other than punishment. So once again, I think the department's language doesn't particularly talk about punishing punishment or consequences. So I'm working with Representative Juergens. I applaud his efforts to continue to try to strengthen this language, and we'll also work with the department. I don't think that this language from the department gets us there. Thank you.
And thank you, Ms. Webster. And we will be hearing Representative Juergens' bill next week. So
thank you.
Continue to work with him and the department. Is there any other person to testify or questions from members?
Thank you very much, Ms. Webster. Will you return MDE to Article 6, Early Childhood and Family Support?
Article 6, Section 1, with language starting at line 2010, this would add language that would allow children in protective services or experiencing homelessness to qualify for early learning scholarships without going through the income verification process. So anecdotally, we're hearing about families that are in these tough circumstances and don't have their tax returns or the materials on hand that they would need to prove their income. I would also note that at line 20.19, it looks like we're removing foster care students from the priority recipients of scholarships. They are covered by language also at 2010 and underneath the definition of child protective services under statute 260C.007. So foster care students are still priority recipients under this proposal. Section 2, with language starting at 22.8, this clarifies that children receiving early learning scholarships are required to receive an early learning screening either within 90 days of receiving the scholarship or 90 days of their third birthday. There are some students who receive an early learning scholarship in that 0 to 2 range, largely siblings of recipients, and the early learning screening is developmentally appropriate for a 3-year-old. So that is clarifying language. And then Section 3, relevant language at 22.26, this strikes an obsolete provision that allowed the early learning scholarship pilot sites to participate in the statewide program for early learning scholarships prior to being rated through the state's quality rating and improvement system.
Thank you, Ms. Snyder. Are there any questions? Anyone in the audience who wants to testify? Thank you, Ms. Snyder. You're really doing a great job. She's been doing these trials. And in my office, she was nervous that her trial run was not going to be very good, but she did really well. It was in board. But she's doing even better.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Reading through this quickly, line 22.8 mm-hmm. and 22.9, I feel like there needs to be a period after the child's third birthday, but I don't understand if a child under the age of 3 is awarded a scholarship. I'm feeling like there's a real disconnect there.
Ms. Pear, will you comment on that if you think?
Madam Chair, Representative Ward. That could be clarified to say, or for a child under the age of 3 awarded a scholarship within 90 days after the child's third birthday. Would that?
You see, yeah. The Representative Board, we have Ms. Pear for a reason, mm-hmm. not to put down the department's writer, but she's always able to bring the verbiage to a very succinct point.
So it doesn't make sense the way it's written, right?
We'll really consider that correction. Thank you. She'll be preparing this bill anyway in its final stage. So thank you, and no need to respond to that department.
Perfect.
It wasn't your problem. It's just the way things come to us. Is there anyone who wanted to address anything in that article? So let's go to our final article, Article 7, Self-Sufficiency and Lifelong Learning.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, there's a fair amount of language here in Sections 1, 2, and 3, but they're all related to the transition last year from referencing GED in statute to high school equivalency test. When we were having these conversations last year, and as you go through the RFP process, there's interest in potentially having more than one high school equivalency test selected by the state. So these are clarifications that would allow the department to select more than one high school equivalency test. The one thing that I would note in following up on a question from our walkthrough, on line 24.6, there is a deletion of a cross-reference to a repealed rule. So that's just clarifying something since we have this section in our bill. And I would stand for any questions.
Are there any questions for members? Very good. Are there any further questions or discussion from members before we complete this process tonight? Hearing none, seeing none, the chair will renew the motion that 3315, as amended, be laid over as the omnibus vehicle. Thank you very much, members. Next week, we're going to probably have a late Tuesday. If you noticed on the agenda, we are going to hear, at least as planned now, the data privacy proposal that Representative Eric Lucero has been working on. I think I owe it to him as a colleague who's worked very hard on it, and it's been re-referred to us to hear it. We'll have to make a decision as to what we want to do with it as we hear it and decide whether we're going to re-refer it to finance, lay it over. I have some issues that still have to be worked out, which I think you probably do too. Representative Pryor.
Just to say, I know that Representative Lucero's met with, I think he's trying to meet with all of us, and we do appreciate the work he is putting on it.
That's very professional of him to do that.
And so we appreciate that, what he's doing.
I agree, and that's why I think I owe it to him to have this bill heard. Representative Mariani, any closing comments?
I agree.
Very good. Thank you. So, members,
just a question.
Representative Ward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So Tuesday night is the training dinner starting at 6. Mm-hmm. Would we be starting at 4? 3:30? 4?
Representative Ward, that dinner starts at 6 and goes how long?
Till 9.
Till 9.
Mm-hmm. It's a training.
Well, it's always possible that we won't need the evening, but we have told Representative Lucero that we think we might. So if we could start maybe at 4:45, as soon as... Well, we could try that. We'll see what kind of room...
Also, the loop night.
I know. I know. That's what happens when we have early deadlines. This meeting stands adjourned.